And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to talk about tomorrow's much anticipated speech. That's right. Our governor is going to give the State of the State address. And for a lot of folks that I know, a lot of people that I talk to, the State of the State in big trouble. And a lot of work needs to be done. We've got crumbling roads and bridges. We've got an education system that is in serious trouble. And we've got a governor who's hell-bent on privatizing, well, everything. And I'm fully expecting part of the speech to be, hey, what can we sell off next? A wholesale clearance of everything held by the public sphere. Also going to talk about where's all the money? Where's the money? And who got it? I loved all the commercials during the Super Bowl. My local news telling me that, oh, hey, stick around because we're going to tell you who's getting rich off of those government handouts. Poor people getting rich off those government handouts. Yeah, it's poor people. Blows the mind. Also going to talk about Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski's little song and dance. You know, the senator from Alaska, she gave an amusing speech today full of, you know, the drill baby drill stuff, only in a different light. Some new definitions of clean energy, some new definitions you are going to want to stick around for because pure gems, pure genius, linguistic mastery. Well, not so much. Anyway, we're going to talk about the poor wealthy people. Oh, the poor wealthy. Oh, what are they to do? Where are they going to go? And where should they die to avoid supporting the structure that made them the wealth class that they are? Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can always email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. Big game yesterday. How many watched? How many didn't? Was it worth it? I sat through the 34-minute power outage going, I bet you those weren't union electricians that wired that place. But up, rest assured, the CIA, I guess, is looking in. Who knows? Thought it was quite interesting watching one of the Harbaugh brothers, the Ravens guy, go losing his mind. Like the guy on the field with the walkie-talkie was going to be able to magically fix it. Very interesting. But what I found, what caught my attention, and look, you know, the game was what it was. I had really no skin in the game, could care less who won, who lost. Not a Ravens fan. You know, a kid growing up in Cleveland, I hated the way Modell moved the team from Cleveland to Baltimore. I hated the fact that taxpayer money was thrown in. And I hated the fact that the reality is the game's all about money from the beginning. But one of the things that got me, I did waste about an hour watching the pregame, which I rarely ever do. Because, you know, how much of this can you fill for? And I guess the pregame was like 4, 5, 10, 100 hours. Who knows? It was forever. And you can only get so many fluff pieces, and you can only do so many, you know, oh, this, that, the other thing. I watched the interview Shannon Sharpe did with Ray Lewis. Now, look, I know virtually nothing about what went on in 2000. I know virtually nothing other than the fact that two people were stabbed to death. And that's all I know. It was after the Super Bowl in 2000 in Atlanta. There was a fight. Fights happen. Two people were stabbed. Is what it is. All I know is Ray Lewis has been taking a lot of slack for it because evidently he was there, was part of the brawl, part of what happened, who knows, pled guilty to something, obstruction of justice, I believe, settled cash out of hand. You know, let's do away with this, here's some money, go away. And, you know, I don't care. But what I found really interesting about the interview that Sharpe did with Lewis is the godding it up. And it infuriates me when I think that someone's doing the whole God thing because, oh, it's a good PR. Do you really believe it? Is he really? Who knows? But it just seemed to me not genuine. It seemed to me to be, you know, hey, I got to go do something for the rest of my life. Talking to religious people, good gig. I don't know. But he was asked by Sharpe what he would say to the families. And he went into this whole long song and dance, and the quote is, he's, you know, Sharpe asked him the question, what would you say to the families? And Lewis says it's simple. God has never made a mistake. That's just who he is, you see. And if our system It's the sad thing about our system. If our system took the time to really investigate what happened 13 years ago, maybe they would have gotten to the bottom line truth. But the saddest thing ever was that a man looked me in my face and told me, "We know you didn't do it, but you're going down for it anyway." So he finally gets around to answering the question. He says, to the family. And this is the part that it ate out at me for the whole game. He said to the family, if you really knew the way God works, he don't use people who commit anything like that for his glory. No way. It's the total opposite. So, I mean, I hear this and I go, wow, if that was something that a PR person came up with to help you, hey, let's spin this into the next career because, hey, big moment, big stage. Maybe you're the next Michael Strahan, who knows? I don't know that condescending is the way to go. I don't know that, well, if they really knew who God was, and they don't, because I do, I'm the guy. I don't know that that was the route to go. It stuck me. And, you know, there was some softball, follow-up questions, and I just stepped back and I go, you know, this is, I don't know. It seemed contrived, and I give Boomer Esiason credit for saying, look, you know, who knows? He paid off the families. He says, I get that. It's fine. But that doesn't take away from who he is as a football player. And he goes to Shannon Sharp. He goes, I appreciate you going down there and asking him that direct question. I'm not so sure I buy the answer. And I'm with Esiason. Don't buy the answer. But here again, not my concern. One of the things I do agree with, though, had law enforcement investigated a lot of crimes, not just this one, maybe we would get, and maybe if we had the resource, and maybe, just maybe, if people like him would have said, hey, this is what happened, maybe he wouldn't have gotten himself into that mess. I don't know. It was just a very strange interview, and an even, kind of even stranger game. The end of it, the Ravens won, as you saw. For me, big moment. I have a favorite billionaire, and I got to see my favorite billionaire on TV. And I'm sure the millions of people who lost their jobs so that we could have a billionaire, I'm sure they were thrilled at the fact that Stephen Schatz Piscotty, the owner of the Baltimore Ravens, Mr. 298 on the Forbes 400, actually moved up some slots. Good for him. Outsourcing must be good. Oh, did I tell you where he made his money? That's right, outsourcing. Shipping jobs overseas, outsourcing from one company to another, you know, so that we can really blur the lines of what an employee is and isn't. And look, he didn't make it up. He was just a guy who played the game. The problem with the game is we've got politicians who are bought and paid for by the very wealthy. So it's no surprise. But my favorite billionaire was right there front and center, not once, not twice, three, four, five times. So good. He's also the 913th richest person in the world. So, hey, there you go. Owns the Baltimore Ravens. And I go back to the whole Ravens story. You know, how they were able to, and growing up in Cleveland, I remember this whole story very vividly. It was about the whole move of the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore was not about ticket sales. It was not about fan loyalty. It was not about, the city being allegiance, having some allegiance to the team. Well, it had nothing to do with that. Parking. Had everything to do with parking. Had everything to do with hot dogs. Had everything to do with loge boxes. That's what it was about. Nothing about the game. Nothing about the fans. It was all about the money. How much we could suck out of the city. And the city and Modell wanted the parking money, which the city had, since the city owned the stadium and all of that. Modell wanted a new stadium. Wanted to get the parking, the concessions, and the skyboxes for himself. So he could be more of a rich guy. And, you know, I looked at the ticket values of the big game. The face value, I blew my mind. You know, face value, $850. To $1,250 to go see a football game. Then you go to Ticketmaster and you see where they're selling them for. The one of the lowest prices I saw was somewhere around $2,300 I'm sure that's the 850 range, the nosebleeds where, hey, I was there. I didn't see anything, but I was there. All the way up to over 13,000. You go down there and you look at how much was a can of beer there at the big game? $14 for a can of beer and $12 for an alligator sausage. You'd have to be a billionaire to end up to go to one of these games. And it's a good thing that they are. And it's a good thing that you and I sacrificed for it. Because, you know, you look at all of these stadiums, you look at, and New Orleans is the perfect example, how much money out of Hurricane Katrina went to renovating and fixing up the stadium there. The numbers were kind of mind-blowing. In fact, Bloomberg News did a report on it. Talks headed by the then NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue led to a plan to fix and renovate the Superdome with $121 million from the state, $44 million from the Louisiana Stadium and Exposition District, which oversees the facility, $156,000 from the Federal Emergency Management FEMA, and $15 million from the league. Ultimately, the financing cost the district, the one who was supposed to spend $44 million, cost them more than three times that amount. And you go down the line, how much did the taxpayers get screwed on this all the way down the line? And you look at all of the stadium deals, you know, one in Minnesota, you look at Cincinnati, you look at all of them. While we're taking from education, while we're taking from programs to help the least among us, we're handing untold amounts of money to these billionaires who could do this themselves. That's why I give Jerry Jones credit. At least he built his own stadium. I'm sure he got some money through the back door, but at least he built his own. And I look at this and I go, you know, at a time when we're talking about major austerity, we're talking about gutting education and gutting health care and, oh, well, we're not going to take the Medicaid expansion because someday down the road it may cost us something. You know, the heck with those hundreds of thousands of people that we're going to insure, the millions that will get insured. No. We've got to pay homage to the billionaire class. We've got to fund their stadiums and their big games. And we got to pay for the commercials because they get to write that off as their advertising budget anyway. The billionaires, folks, they're just fine. Shots will be fine. I'm worried about the beer vendor. I'm worried about the small business person in that area. That, well, you know, they saw a little bit of bump this weekend. But what did it cost in the long run? I'm gonna take a quick break. When we come back, gonna talk a little bit about the governor's speech tomorrow. Gonna find out what's gonna talk about. Quick break. Back after this.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The International Longshoremen's Association says it's confident that ILA members will be satisfied with details of the master contract agreement at East Coast ports. ILA President Harold Daggett said he can assure ILA members that, quote, the protections of our jurisdiction and increased benefits and wages were achieved, end quote. The tentative agreement reached Friday must still be ratified by both ILA members and the members of the United States Maritime Alliance. Local port agreements must also still be concluded. Daggett says the union came up in this negotiation with landmark agreements on automation, protection of chassis work, and powerful jurisdiction language. Daggett says the ILA now will take its full attentions to achieving equally successful local agreements. The deal averted a possible strike ahead of a February 6th deadline for the negotiations. As the Affordable Care Act heads towards full implementation in 2014, SEIU healthcare chair Dr. Tony Lewis says one of the most important issues for SEIU is the continuing disparity in healthcare access in America along economic and racial lines.
Health inequality tied to income inequality is the biggest issue of our time right now, and the Affordable Care Act is a great tool to move us forward. There still exists so many disparities in care based on your income, the color of your skin, where you happen to live. That's just not right in this country. I feel there are opportunities in the Affordable Care Act, whether it's the $11 billion going into community health centers, whether it's the focus on prevention, whether it's the deep activity that SEIU and community organizations are doing to enroll everyone in all different communities to fix that.
Another chapter in the relentless attack on union rights for workers is beginning to unfold in Pennsylvania. Right-wing Republicans are pushing so-called right-to-work legislation in Pennsylvania that could cripple the ability of unions to collect dues and keep all workers in an organized workplace as union members. The Center for Media and Democracy says it's no accident that this is coming soon after a similar push in Michigan. The center says it's part of an effort by American Legislative Exchange Council backed by a witch's brew of right-wing groups like the billionaire Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and the Tea Party. Brandon Fisher of the Center for Media and Democracy says this looks like a state-by-state march attacking unions and labor rights in an effort to weaken progressive politicians and progressive groups. Those efforts have already been made in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale told Working in These Times the right-to-work attack is firmly opposed by Democrats and some union-friendly Republicans in the state legislature. He says the measure has been blocked before, and he believes it will be blocked again. Governor Tom Corbett, though, has said that if the Pennsylvania legislature passes the anti-union bill, he will sign it. This newscast made possible in part thanks to underwriting from the OPEIU, Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax cuts?
Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced two previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
So he wakes up at 3:30 in the morning. Where are we going to get the money to balance the budget? Well, he seemed to find it off the backs of those least able to really keep him up at 3:30 in the morning. I mean, if you really stop and think about it, it just blows my mind. But, you know, I listened to some of his press conferences, and, you know, the stories he tells of people that he talks to, it tells me who he's hanging out with. Because, you know, I don't think I've ever had a serious conversation with anybody who goes, boy, I wish we could sell the liquor store so there'd be more liquor around. I don't think I've ever had that conversation, and I've yet to find anyone who has. So, again, who is he hanging out with? You know, I know very few people who say, you know what, it'd be a great idea if we sold the liquor store so that we could pay for education. That'd be a great idea. Most people I talk to say, you know, we should probably fund that as a matter of course. It should be part of what we do, part of the betterment of society, the good and welfare of the nation, you know, stuff like that. Instead of going, gee, I hope vice spending is up this year. I hope a lot of people are depressed and go hit the bottle so we can pay for education. I know very few people who say, you know what, I think I'm going to go out and gamble today so that granny can get a new hip. I just don't have these conversations with folks. And I know very few working people who do. So it kind of makes me wonder, you know, who's he talking to? I do talk to a lot of people who say, you know what, I wish the roads and bridges were better so my car wouldn't have to go in for repairs, which is kind of what I'm hoping to hear tomorrow. There's part of me that says, you know, there's got to be something good that comes out of his mouth tomorrow, something at least, you know, hey, maybe we're gonna do some road projects, maybe fix some more bridges, maybe gonna dust off that plan that they came up with. Some of it's not bad. Some of it is. I'm not a huge fan of public-private partnerships, but hey, you know, got to get people back to work. We need programs that for public transportation. I look what he's allowed to happen in Pittsburgh. Is that going to happen across the state? Cut, cut, cut. What are we going to see that K-12 education? Will there be more cuts, or are the is the budget predicated on us selling the wine and spirit shops off to fund education? And what happens if it doesn't work? Are we looking at another $1 billion slash to K-12 education? What about the cost of college? Are they going to get hacked again, or will you see another year of flat funding? All things we need to be talking about. I know the pension thing is going to be front and center. The question is where does he go with it? You know the defined contribution thing is going to come up. You know they want a 401k for state workers. That doesn't take a genius to figure out. Question is how are they going to mitigate the costs of going to a system like that? Because as we all know, now that you've just, they've decided, I truly believe they decided this a couple years ago, that they were, because it's ideology, it's not fact-based, pure ideology, that, you know, those workers in the public sector, they should have crummy benefits like the people in the private sector. So that 401k, that's really 200.5, that's really not funding your retirement. We're going to move the public sector workers into that. And the question is, what happens to the current employees? Because I know what's going to happen to the future ones. They're going to sell them down the river even further than they already have. This 10-year vesting period makes most workers go, yeah, I don't care what happens. And that's what it's supposed, that's what it's meant to do. But what about the current employees? I do think the multiplier is going to be rolled back even further. I do think that they're going to change a lot of the calculations. Probably going to happen anyway. They're going to modify the option 4, which I guess is where you can take your money and run. I think if they do pass that, you will see a lot of people take their money and run, which will make the problem that much worse. Because at a time when the market is still down and the fund is still down, you're going to have a huge withdrawal. And again, it shows to me that we're talking about people who are ideologically driven and not so much fact-driven. But here again, it's really never been about facts for Republicans. It's about belief. And the big question is, and we saw Ohio, in Ohio, Governor Kasich said that they're going to set up their exchange, their marketplace, whatever you want to call it. They're going to take the Medicaid expansion money. Question is will Corbett? And the Republicans had their little press conference, their little dog and pony show, you know, where they said, oh, we can't do this because we can't trust the federal government, who tells us that they're going to pay 100% of the expansion costs till the year 2020. So for the next 6 years, 100% of the cost after it's implemented, of course, January 1st of 14, those 6 years, 100%. You're going to cover, and it blew my mind when I saw how many people would be covered. They have said that it's going to cover anywhere from 800,000 people to 1.4 million people. You go, wow, this is huge. What could that do to help the health of the people in our state? What could that do getting those folks insured to bring down costs by getting more people so that they're not using the ER as their family doctor? You know, what could that do to help? So the Republicans are saying, no, don't do it. I'm not going to let it happen. And my representative, Stephen Bloom, was one of the ones front and center. Got to get his mug on the paper. So his basic argument is very twisted, but his basic argument is no Medicaid expansion because Medicaid basically kills people. And I guess according to him, there are studies that prove that Medicaid, the people on Medicaid are sick and they die. Now remember, Medicaid is for the very, very poor. So I guess the argument he's making does have some basis, albeit a real long stretch. In the newspaper, Bloom was quoted as saying that Medicaid is a flawed program that underpays healthcare providers and imposes a huge bureaucratic burden, and that people covered by Medicaid are worse off than people with no insurance. So explain to me how that works. How is it that if I have Medicaid and I can go to the doctor and get a checkup, and if my kid gets sick, I can go to the doctor, how is that worse than having no insurance? Bloom says the program actually hurts the people it's intended to help. How exactly does that work? Because I'm struggling with that. And this is the Republican mentality. Well, it's a government program. I'd rather die. Like, well, go ahead. Well, hurry along with it already. The reality is I know a lot of people who need health care. And we just came back from a two-day conference. And look, I'm not, nor have I ever been a huge Obamacare fan. I was a single-payer guy from the very beginning. The simplistic answer was Medicare for everybody. Open it up, affix a price to it, and put subsidies where you needed it. Simple. But you had a recalcitrant Republican Party hell-bent on scorched earth where nothing was going to get done. And I know, oh, you know, Rick, you know, the Democrats rammed it down their throats. Yeah, right. People like Jason Altmaier, a former healthcare executive, rammed it down your throat. Good Democrat that made sure that things got held up a little longer. And I look at this and I say, you know what? This is what we've got. This is what we've got to work with. This is what we've got to get upwards of 1.4 million people in the Commonwealth some coverage, some health security, so that they don't go bankrupt, so they don't end up in the streets, so they don't end up in the poorhouse. And yet somehow, according to Stephen Bloom, well, you know, it'd be better if they had nothing. Explain that to me, because I'm struggling with it. It makes no sense on any level. Now, one could make the argument that people on Medicaid do have worse outcomes because they're generally the poorest of the poor. They're generally sick because, hey, you had that private sector job, you had that health insurance, then you got sick. And guess what? Premiums, deductibles, co-pays, all that stuff ate up whatever savings you had. And then you know what? You got to a certain point where your employer says, sorry, you can't come to work. We're going to have to let you go. Oh, guess what happens? Your health care goes away. And for anybody who's lost a job, how expensive is COBRA? Because they didn't really figure out how. They gave you this wonderful thing called COBRA. Once you lose a job, you can keep your health care. I know when I got laid off, they sent me the COBRA payments, $1,100 a month. I don't know about you, but I know very few people who, when they make 40% of what they used to make, capped out at about $575 a week. I don't know how many of those people could then turn around and cover themselves for $1,100 for health insurance. Yeah, just a thought. But explain to me how it is better to have nothing. Now, you're looking at the sickest of the sick, the people who they had private sector jobs, they had public sector jobs, they had health insurance, they're sick, they're broke. They end up on Medicaid. Yeah, you've got the sickest of the sick. Which is why I've said from the beginning, same thing with Medicare. You know, we take the high-risk folks. And they even tried to divide that with the Medicare Advantage. Well, we'll take the very healthy people, and you can get a good rate, and you'll get good insurance, as long as you're healthy. Because heaven forbid, if you get sick, your premiums jack up. And then you can decide to go back onto traditional Medicare. It was a scheme designed to destroy the program. So what I said is simple, and it's what I've said from the beginning. It's what I believe we're going to eventually have to get to. One big pot. Everybody in. One big pot. Young people, old people, everybody. So that during all those years in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, and into your 50s, when you're like me, I've had one real medical emergency. And all the rest of those years, I just paid to make sure that everyone else had coverage. Because it is an insurance. Kind of like socialism. Kind of is. Insurance is a lot like socialism. You're right. That's how it works. Risk pooling. You know, all of that. Everybody pulling their resources so that we have some floor beneath everyone's foot. Problem is we allowed the capitalists to destroy that and say, well, we want profit off of this too. And this is where the big money has weighed in. Understand, the hospital association, the people who run the hospitals, they want something done. AARP, people who represent people over 50, 55, they want something done. Because both understand. The hospitals, they're spending $1 billion a year to care for people who don't have any medical insurance. And they're saying, you know what, if we don't get some reimbursement, we're not going to survive. AARP saying, look, you know, people over 50, when they lose a job, they can't find health insurance. Not that they can afford, anyway. But I love the simplistic Republican argument. And they sent a letter to the governor saying, well, 36 of them say, don't do it. And that gives me hope. When only 36 of the the vast majority there in the House. I think 100. Only 36 sign it. That gives me hope. Because maybe there's some sane, rational Republicans left. Maybe there are some who care about their fellow citizens, the people of this Commonwealth, a little bit more than their ideology. Just a hope, just a thought, maybe even a prayer to go along with it. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The powers that be say that the bulk of America's middle-class manufacturing jobs are gone and won't be coming back. High-tech jobs are being outsourced too, as are accountants, lawyers, and some other professional positions. So where does this leave us? Grasping at straws, the most abundant of which are retail jobs. But wait, those aren't jobs, they're jobettes. Part-time, poverty pay, no benefits, lousy schedules, little training, and no advancement opportunity. Most big retail chains treat their employees as nothing but a drain on profits, not an asset to invest in. Salespeople are typically paid only $10 an hour. Clerks get only $9.70, and cashiers just $9. Worse, 94% of retailers define full-time work as only 30 hours a week. People can't make ends meet on that, and America can't have a healthy economy without a solid middle class. Yet 15 million people are in retail work now, and it's to be our second biggest source of new jobs for the next decade. Well, shrug the powers that be, the retail giants must compete on low prices, so they have no choice but to keep cutting corners on their workforce. As we say in Texas, bovine excrement. Look at Trader Joe's, where full-time jobs start at $40,000. Or at Costco, where employee retainment is a priority and 98% of managers are promoted from within. Low-price chains that invest directly in workers are reaping industry highs in performance, morale, customer satisfaction, and profits. Bad jobs are not a retail necessity, just a corporate choice. This is Jim Hightower saying, this week, a Retail Justice Alliance has been launched to push America's employers and policymakers to turn retail jobs into good jobs that spread a middle-class standard of living and rebuild our grassroots economy. Learn more at RetailJusticeAlliance.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Ah, yes, he's a Republican, and or she. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app, take the program on the go. So Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska, she laid out her energy policy blueprint at the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners at their annual meeting in Washington, D.C., by saying energy is good. Energy is good. She has a 5-point plan. She wants to make energy abundant, affordable, clean, diverse, and secure. And she went through this whole song and dance. And, you know, again, what it really is it's Drill Baby Drill dressed up a little differently. And, you know, got to understand from Alaska, oil, you know, we want to drill more. We want more. We want ANWR. We want all of this other stuff, just with a little different approach. And, you know, she went through her little song and dance. And I loved how she described the need for her report and even the cover of her report. She said this.
The cover is a map of the world. And it's from space at night, so the grids are all lit up. And you can look at this, and you can tell where the prosperous countries in the world are. And it's because the lights are on. And so in my state of Alaska, as my two commissioners know, in too many parts of the state, our lights aren't on.
No.
In too many countries around the world, our lights aren't on. So when we talk about how we can address our environmental challenges, it is when we are prosperous and secure.
I don't know what that means. How'd you go from the lights being on, being prosperous? That's how you become environmental. I love the map from space because the lights are on. Could it be that we're just wasting a lot? People are sleeping with the light. Who knows? Wow. She talks about her principles, though. The big report, lays it out. It's very stark terms.
Within our report, we declare 5 principles. In addition to energy is good, I'm trying to make this really simple for everybody through the morning fog of a Monday morning. Energy is good. And then there's 5 principles. It is in our national interest to make energy abundant, affordable, clean, diverse, and secure. I've even put them in alphabetical order for ease of memory.
Because you're stupid.
No acronyms here this morning. That's just going to confuse. Alphabetical is good.
She goes on to talk about abundance, because you know what? We've got to have abundant energy. And look, in some sectors, you need to be able to keep the lights on, so to speak. We've got a prison economy to worry about.
As the standard of living rises globally, demand for energy will continue to grow. And anyone who has experienced a blackout, it's amazing how this blackout last night just ties into everything I've got to say this morning. But anyone who's ever experienced a Super Bowl blackout or a gasoline shortage doesn't need an explanation of the value of energy abundance.
I'm not quite sure how having an abundance of energy and the plug being pulled come together, but you take it for what it is. At the bottom line, it comes down to the cost. And she goes through her whole spiel about the cost.
The direct cost of energy affects the cost of everything.
Really?
Of everything that we do.
Wow.
And there is nothing else
that
impacts our economy so directly as energy. Whether it's individuals that are struggling to fill up their gas tanks or pay their electric bills, whether it's our business leaders that are making decisions on investments based on the cost of power server farms or smelters or whatever it is, we all recognize that lower cost is better. That's what everybody's seeking. That's what they're all seeking.
Yeah, lower is better, like lower wages, less benefits, less health care, cut your pension, cut your wages. Lower is better. And when you have this business mentality, that she obviously has, drill baby drill and cheap energy for, because understand, she's not talking about you and me. I love the little throw-in about, oh, energy for your car. Get out of here. Yeah, I listened to some of the, some more talking about, you know, the cleaner energy.
As we attempt to minimize indirect costs or the externalities by driving up these prices, again, I would suggest that this is a policy that's doomed to economic and practical failure. Instead, we have to be aware of the impacts of every type of energy and make rational, informed decisions on what is acceptable, what needs to be mitigated, how do we do just that. Our challenge here is to reduce the cost of cleaner sources of energy, not raise the cost of existing sources.
So what you're saying is, well, we don't need to take into effect the damage that we're doing. Those externalities. Don't worry about the damage, the environmental degradation. Don't worry about that. We just need to have the cheapest price. So if we can get the cheapest price for oil, let's say, instead of solar, and even though the oil and all of the drilling and all that stuff and natural gas, all the drilling is destroying your environment, we should be going with the cheaper cost. Don't worry about the external stuff. Don't worry about the destruction. Somebody will clean that up later. Somebody else will deal with it. Somebody else's problem. That's basically what she's saying. She goes on to talk about this.
Next is clean. As we attempt to minimize indirect costs or the externalities by driving up these prices, again, I would suggest that this is a policy that's doomed to economic and practical failure, treated as an absolute. But I would contend that it is better regarded as a comparison.
Yeah, it's a comparison. What comparison are you talking about, Lisa? And here's the definition, and I love this.
And when we talk about clean, what we've tried to do in this report is to give it some definition here. Too often, clean is treated as an absolute. But I would contend that it is better regarded as a comparison. A better definition of clean, in my view, and what we have used in this report is less intensive in global lifestyle impacts than its likeliest alternative. So just consider that.
I'm considering it.
Less intensive in global lifestyle impacts.
You couldn't even get it right twice. What was that again?
Less intensive in global lifestyle impacts than its likeliest alternative.
Huh. Wouldn't clean energy just work as well? Anyway, here's the point of her whole spiel.
There is a lot that we can do. But the question is whether or not we will actually do it. Are we going to push ourselves to do this? Are we going to believe that we really can? Abundant energy is absolutely possible. There have already been signs of it becoming a reality. Technological breakthroughs have lowered the cost of producing previously uneconomic supplies. New technologies are making these clean energy sources, again, those sources that have less environmental impact than their most likely alternatives. These are coming forward. They're increasingly competitive. They're enabling energy efficiency to continue to improve, which is all good.
It's all good. It's all good. And what she's talking about, honestly, if you read the report, it's the gas. It's the drilling. It's more of the same. And she goes into talking about, you know, what we need to do is do away with regulation, do away with any investment in alternatives. Just right down the line. It's coal, it's nuclear, it's oil. And she wants to invest in, and I'm not so much against the dams idea. There's some things to look at, but you know, wants to make sure that coal has a place. They want to slow the decline of coal. Which you go, really? Okay. Well, these are the people that we've elected. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
In early 2013, a new company called Deep Space Industries became the second company in about a year to join what's being called the New Asteroid Gold Rush.
Scientists have known for decades that there are rich fields of water and precious metals available in near-Earth asteroids. Now, for the first time, companies are seriously queuing up to be among the first to gather those resources. Deep Space Industries has announced plans to build what it calls the world's first fleet of commercial asteroid prospecting spacecraft.
Deep Space Industries' chairman is Rick Tumlinson, who signed up the world's first space tourist, led the team that took over the Mir space station, was a founding trustee of the XPRIZE, and more. His company has named its first class of spacecraft Firefly, and said the craft will be launched in 2015 on journeys that'll last 2 to 6 months.
Then, starting in 2016, Deep Space says it'll begin launching a larger craft called Dragonfly for round-trip visits to asteroids that'll bring back samples.
More than 900 new asteroids that pass near Earth are discovered every year. Deep Space said that those asteroids can be like the Iron Range of Minnesota was for the Detroit car industry last century, a key resource located near where it was needed.
In this case, the vision is to use metals and fuel from asteroids to expand the in-space industries of this century. We have more at EarthSky.org. Search for asteroid mining. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Matt Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Texas is a right to work state. Texas is a great state.
Well, pardon me if I don't share.
We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe and we don't buy that here. Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down.
We could be the Texas of the Northeast. We could just drill. We could drill till the eyes can. We can just drill, drill, drill all the way to China if we wanted to. And I listened to Murkowski's little spiel today, and it just blows my mind at how many different ways they go about it. And as Andy pointed out in an email during the break, he says, "You know what? BS. Total BS." He said, "My meter went up. No matter how much we drill, baby drill, the prices are set on the world markets." And he points out, look, you know, the reality is, our domestic supply not going to really change the international market and the world demand. He points out Canada's been energy independent, and yet they pay almost the exact price that we pay for gas at the pump. And he has some other nice things to say about Lisa Murkowski. But you look at this report, and I don't even know if she wrote it. Which brings me to, what's our governor going to say tomorrow? Which is why I've asked Myron Arnowitt, Pennsylvania State Director of Clean Water Action, to come talk to us about his thoughts on tomorrow's big speech. Myron, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, glad to be here.
So what are we expecting out of Governor Corbett's speech tomorrow? Anything on gas? Anything on drilling?
Well, I mean, it's a budget address, so, you know, we are prepared for what he usually says in his budget addresses, which is, you know, he's going to cut this and he's going to cut that, and that's what he's done so far, and we're expecting more of the same.
So more of, we're going to fund education through vice spending and senior programs through vice spending, and we're going to give away all of the gas under our feet. We're going to give that away.
Right. I mean, they're talking about, you know, if universities need money, they can drill for gas, you know, on their campuses. And you know, I don't think that's what students are signing up for when they're saying they're going to go to a state college.
Yeah, I watched Lisa Murkowski's speech this morning, and really to me what jumped out at me was this redefining natural gas and redefining all of the drilling we're doing as clean energy. And I love the new definition of clean energy. Did you hear what her new definition is?
No, I haven't heard that.
Listen, this is just blows my mind. The clean energy, this is her definition for clean energy.
Less intensive in global lifestyle impacts than its likeliest alternative.
So, I mean, listen.
Less intensive in global lifestyle impacts than its likeliest alternative.
What the hell does that mean?
It's hard to even figure it out. I mean, they're talking in Pennsylvania We have something called the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard for how we produce electricity. And we're hearing that one of the Corbett initiatives for this year is going to be to try to get nuclear and gas, natural gas, put into this alternative energy standard, you know, alongside things like wind and solar. And it's like, well, why don't we just put coal in there, and then we'll be done. It'll be everything that we could probably be doing.
Well, we could, because we're going to clean it first, right? Because in her report, they want to go back and they want to do that.
Right.
We'll throw some government money into it. This way it won't cost as much. And boom, we've got a new resource.
Yeah, it's funny how you know, somehow they can make fun of subsidies for renewable energy, but then they turn around and subsidize, you know, the huge industries, the oil and gas industry, and the coal industry for billions of dollars a year, and you know, they seem to be able to not have a problem with that.
Yeah, and the 2 years that this guy's been our governor, what has the state of our environment? I mean, if you want to have a state of the state address, we should talk about the state of our environment, the state of oversight in some of these communities that really have no choice in what's going on.
Right. I mean, you know, there's been a real problem over at the DEP under Corbett. You know, it's been cut back, and we're seeing a real problem that, you know, our basic environmental laws aren't enforced. You look at the gas drilling companies in Pennsylvania, they have all sorts of environmental violations. But most of those companies aren't getting any fines whatsoever. You know, the DEP, they'll write up a violation, but there's no price to pay, so the companies just keep violating.
Yeah, as I was watching Murkowski's speech, and you know, I'm kind of stuck on that because I'm waiting for that to filter down to the state levels. And her argument is that we shouldn't be considering the externalities of whatever, the drilling this or the digging or the mountaintop removal or any of that stuff. We should just concentrate on the cost of the finished product. You know, all that other stuff, you know, the water, the air, the heck with that. It's the finished product.
Well, you know, there's a great example of what's so wrong with that in Pennsylvania right now in Butler County. I live in Pittsburgh, so Butler's pretty close to me. And there's a problem there where there's some folks who've had their water contaminated from drilling, and they've lost their water. They're trying to get a new water supply, but it, you know, costs a lot of money to hook up to the nearest public water source for them. So they're trying to get that new impact fee money put into, you know, getting their water back. And, you know, Butler County's been resisting this, and it's like, if you won't even pay for the, you know, the most basic need people have, which is to have clean water, you know, it's hard to see what that impact fee is for.
Yeah, you know, and you brought up a whole new water supply. You know, it's a little bit it's expensive. And Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, a quote from him popped into my mind where he says, you know what, you know, climate change, it's already down the road. We're just going to have to engineer and adapt because, according to Rex, it's what we do. It's how we've lived as long as we are. We'll figure out how to adapt from all of the degradation and all of the destruction that companies like his have caused.
Well, he's hoping to make money off of it while the rest of us have to deal with the problems. That's pretty much ExxonMobil MO.
But, you know, it's a lot of it. I mean, a lot of these, you know, the people who fund the Murkowskis, and I think a big problem that we have is there's so much money into this, so much money into politicians like our governor, like Murkowski, like a lot of these folks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a real problem how much control they have over who's making these decisions because they put so much money into the campaign.
So where should we be going? I mean, you know, when we listen tomorrow, are you expecting anything? Because part of me is not. I think we've already sold that train down the track. The drilling's a done deal. That's already been given away. I'm expecting some other giveaways tomorrow, but I'm curious of your thought.
Well, I mean, I think we'll be looking closely at where some of the environmental funding numbers end up. I mean, we're really pushing for some of these cuts to be restored to the DEP budget, to DCNR's budget, you know, that's something which I think Corbett's gonna stay away from, and you know, that's the piece that we really want to highlight.
Are we expecting a flat line, or are we expecting more cuts in those departments? And what have his last two budgets done to those two departments?
Well, there's been a real slide for DEP. It's been going on for a while. It's been about overall a little over a 40% cut in their budget. And, I mean, they're not even a very big part of the state government, but somehow They always find a way to cut it, you know, a little bit more every year. So we'll be asking for some real answers on, you know, if you're cutting their budget more, you know, who's going to actually be impacted by that?
Well, I guess, you know, the DEP, much like the EPA, they're the pariah. They're the, you know, the job killing people.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing how you know, if you are a guy from Texas who comes to Pennsylvania to work on a natural gas rig, somehow that's creating jobs in Pennsylvania. But when you cut the subsidies for solar power in Pennsylvania, and solar companies are fleeing Pennsylvania right now because, you know, they can't get businesses going here because other states are doing a lot more to attract solar. You know, somehow that's not job killing.
Yeah, I know. I know about it firsthand. We put solar panels on our house a couple years ago,
yeah.
And the Republicans in this state have allowed the SREC credits to go straight to the basement. When I put the panels on, they were like $250 a credit hour, down to like $15 now.
Yeah. And I mean, people are really interested in them. There's a huge demand. But, you know, there's a real unwillingness in the Corbett administration to say, oh, yeah, that's something that's important for our state. It could create jobs, and it could help our environment at the same time. But they, you know, they don't want to go that way.
And you think about, as you pointed out, the jobs that were lost because of it, because the people who put the panels on my house and some other folks I know who were doing it, they're out of it now. We're on to something else, and doing a lot of work in New Jersey where the credits are through the roof.
Right. No, exactly. Exactly. And, I mean, there are some legislators, Representative Vitale from Delaware County has been pushing some new legislation to really revitalize solar in Pennsylvania. And you know, could be a really great thing for the state. But, you know, it's hard to see the Corbett administration signing up for that at this point.
Yeah, I don't see anything good coming out of his speech tomorrow. And I really don't see anything good on the environment. It's just one of those things. Myron, I appreciate the time. It's great talking with you.
Sure. Good to talk to you, too.
Myron Arnowitt, Pennsylvania State Director of Clean Water Action. And you know what? Like I said, the EPA, you know, and how much the Republicans love that.
What we need to do is pass the mother of all repeal bills, but it's the repeal bill that will get a job-killing regulations. And I would begin with the EPA. Because there is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Okay.
There is the Republican view. Quick break. Back with hour two of the program. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The International Longshoremen's Association says it's confident that ILA members will be satisfied with details of the master contract agreement at East Coast ports. ILA President Harold Daggett said he can assure ILA members that, quote, the protections of our jurisdiction and increased benefits and wages were achieved, end quote. The tentative agreement reached Friday must still be ratified by both ILA members and the members of the United States Maritime Alliance. Local port agreements must also still be concluded. Daggett says the union came away from this negotiation with landmark agreements on automation, protection of chassis work, and powerful jurisdiction language. Daggett says the ILA now will turn its full attentions to achieving equally successful local agreements. The deal averted a possible strike ahead of a February 6th deadline. for the negotiations. As the Affordable Care Act heads towards full implementation in 2014, SEIU Healthcare Chair Dr. Tony Lewis says one of the most important issues for SEIU is the continuing disparity in healthcare access in America along economic and racial lines.
Health inequality tied to income inequality is the biggest issue of our time right now, and the Affordable Care Act is a great tool to move us forward. There still exists so many disparities in care based on your income, the color of your skin, where you happen to live. That's just not right in this country. I feel there are opportunities in the Affordable Care Act, whether it's the $11 billion going into community health centers, whether it's the focus on prevention, whether it's the deep activity that SEIU and community organizations are doing to enroll everyone in all different communities to fix that.
Another chapter in the relentless attack on union rights for workers is beginning to unfold in Pennsylvania. Right-wing Republicans are pushing so-called right-to-work legislation in Pennsylvania that could cripple the ability of unions to collect dues and keep all workers in an organized workplace as union members. The Center for Media and Democracy says it's no accident that this is coming soon after a similar push in Michigan. The center says it's part of an effort by American Legislative Exchange Council backed by a witch's brew of right-wing groups like the billionaire Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and the Tea Party. Brandon Fisher of the Center for Media and Democracy says this looks like a state-by-state march attacking unions and labor rights in an effort to weaken progressive politicians and progressive groups. Those efforts have already been made in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale told Working in These Times the right-to-work attack is firmly opposed by Democrats and some union-friendly Republicans in the state legislature. He says the measure has been blocked before, and he believes it will be blocked again. Governor Tom Corbett, though, has said that if the Pennsylvania legislature passes the anti-union bill, he will sign it.
This newscast made possible in part thanks to underwriting from the OPEIU, Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors. How much more financial invested with your day? Get it closer, get it closer. To our landfill, we take the best power from the basement of the property. We really stand still. This is a pain in America's dream.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So I'm waiting for tomorrow. The big speech, I think it's 11:30 tomorrow morning. We're going to find out where the priorities of this governor, well, I mean, we already know where the priorities are. The last two addresses that he's given, the last two budgets he's come out with. What's it done? Well, cut, gut, and punish for those at the bottom. But boy, if you're one of the donors, things look pretty rosy, I guess, at the top. Anyway, I'm expecting... Who knows at this point, which is why we're talking about it tonight. I've asked Lance Haver, director of the mayor's office in Philadelphia, the Office of Consumer Affairs, to come talk to us about, well, what he expects and what the thoughts are on the governor's budget. Lance, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, you're more than welcome. I'm always happy to be on.
You know, I appreciate it. I look at this budget. The last two, not very good when you look at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder. If your poor children in the city of Philadelphia, where they're privatizing schools, your neck's on the chopping block. If you're someone who, low-wage worker who needed health insurance, your neck's on the chopping block. If you're someone on the general assistance budget, you got just completely eviscerated. What are we expecting this year?
Well, I think you're right that this is going to continue to be an attack on poor and working people. I do think it's helpful to go through what you're talking about, which is one of the first acts Governor Corbett did was eliminate adult basic. Then he ended health care for 130,000 eligible people, including 89,000 children. Then he eliminated general assistance for 70,000 Pennsylvanians who have no other income. And as a result, many of those people can't pay for their prescription medicine. And despite the fact that it's a law, a federal law, that a pharmacy has to provide prescription medicine, even if someone can't make a copay, Governor Corbett has refused to enforce that law. So he is forcing people to sell their food stamps and engage in other illegal activity so that they can pay for their prescription medicine. Governor Corbett refused to fund HMAP, which is the program that helps people who are facing mortgage foreclosures because they're out of work or because of illness, because of family problems. We were successful in getting that funded through a settlement with some of the mortgage companies that were bailed out with federal tax dollars that they've been stealing from the American public for years. He has unbelievably cut funding for the unemployment offices at a time when unemployment is still growing in the state of Pennsylvania, and then had his labor secretary actually suggest the problem was created not because they laid off 300 workers, but because of some sabotage.
Yeah, I loved that.
If you think about it for a second, it's actually shocking. Ready? We don't have any money to hire people to help the unemployed get the benefits they have paid for all of their lives. But we do have money to go on a witch hunt to try and find someone to blame for the fact that this labor secretary is unable to run the unemployment office as well. So there's, the money's there. It's just a question of whether we're going to help poor and desperate people or whether we're going to go through a witch hunt and try and create the illusion that it's not incompetency and cold-heartedness that created the problem. LIHEAP is another example. LIHEAP is a low-income home energy assistance program. That's, again, federal dollars. Corbett's administration has the longest backlog in the history of the program. It was developed by President Carter. It has never been this poorly run before. And there is no excuse. It's federal dollars. So it's not really a question of using state dollars. It's not a question of trying to save taxpayers' money. It's a question of being cold-hearted and cruel. He's cut money for social services, child welfare programs, mental health services, drug and alcohol recovery program. And, again, just unbelievably, he's eliminated the programs that help homeless people who are struggling with mental illness get Social Security disability insurance, which would have brought more money into the state. Public transit has not been adequately funded. Schools have not been adequately funded. Colleges have not been adequately funded. And today he announces that his Secretary of Welfare, Secretary Alexander, is going to be leaving, as if somehow he can try and blame someone other than himself for all of these cuts and all these cold-hearted actions.
I mean, this, you're right. This comes right from the very top. It's who he is, and it's the direction they told you we were going to take. I mean, this is, I mean, I give the guy credit. He was honest. It's just we're the dupes who voted for him.
Well, I think there's a level at which it's very hard to believe someone could do this when they're running for office. You know, many of us believe that there is waste and mismanagement, and for some reason the right wing is able to focus us on worrying about waste and mismanagement in food stamp programs, in LIHEAP programs, and they don't get us involved in worrying about wasted mismanagement in the military budget or in the SEC, which regulates the stock market investment, where they don't get us to talk about waste and all of the types of problems that happened in the banking industry. So that they're successful at pitting us against each other, in part because
Absolutely.
We fall for it, and in part because we're suffering so much.
That's an excellent point. And one of the things I'm looking forward to tomorrow, I see, you know, Governor Kasich in Ohio decided to take the Medicaid expansion money. Our governor hasn't, I don't know, he hasn't said if he's going to or not. There's a big push by the Republicans to get him to not take it. And I love what my state representative said today in the press conference, that the program actually helps the people it's intended to hurt. He said basically that the people who are covered by Medicaid are worse off than people who have no insurance, which I'm still trying to figure that one out. But, you know, hey, these are people who believe. Facts don't matter.
Well, I don't have an explanation for that statement. I'm trying to stop from laughing. How someone who doesn't have health insurance is better off than someone who does have health insurance. If he actually believes that, I'm kind of surprised he doesn't give up his health insurance. Because it would seem to me that if he thinks people without health insurance are better off, then he would certainly not want his taxpayer health insurance any longer. And I'm sure he could find someone to give it to. I'm sure there's an awful lot of working families right now who would like to have the same benefits he has. And if he thinks that it's a disservice for him to have it, I would suggest he just donates it to a family in this district.
Yeah, one of the roughly 800,000 that the expansion is going to help.
Well, you know, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid, when they looked at Pennsylvania, believes that it's going to be 719,000 additional Pennsylvanians that will enroll in Medicaid if it's expanded by the year 2022. And this whole idea that it's going to cost the state money is really kind of, again, just a misstatement. For the first 4 years, all of the money comes from the federal government. For the next 4 years, $4 billion a year, every year, will be coming from the federal government into Pennsylvania. And that will pay for health insurance, which does the following. It allows for everybody's health insurance costs to be kept down, because when someone goes into the hospital, they get services. And what happens is the hospitals just raise the cost on everybody else. So having uncompensated care, the idea that someone goes into the hospital, doesn't pay, that bill automatically disappears, is Wizard of Oz type thinking. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. That bill just shows up on my health insurance and your health insurance and everyone who's lucky enough to have health insurance. So by making sure everybody has health insurance, the 719,000 people who we get it as a result of the expansion, what that means is we're going to keep the cost of health care down, not just for the people who are getting Medicaid, but for everyone, because now people can see doctors and have preventative care. They will not be forced to use the emergency rooms as their waiting rooms and as their general practitioners. People will get a better quality of care. There'll be fewer absentee at work. The productivity will go up. The hospitals will be able to have a much better way of regulating costs and keeping prices down. It's better for everyone. And the idea that somehow we should, the state of Pennsylvania should turn down this tremendous opportunity is one of those things that's just very difficult to conceive of. And I think part of the difficulty we have in fighting back is we scratch our heads and we say, well, how could anyone want to turn away $4 billion a year? Because in the fifth year, the state would have to pay 10% of that. Why would you want to turn that away when it helps poor and working people, it helps middle-class people, it keeps health insurance down, keeps people healthy, makes us more productive, and helps hospitals and doctors? Why would you say no to that?
Well, because the believers are against it. They, you know, it's, and there's part of me that goes, it's only because the black guy in the White House is the one who got it pushed through.
Well, I'm not going to suggest that we still don't live in a racist society. Of course we do, but I think that the bigger problem is that we are not organized. We as progressives often spend our time criticizing each other progressive and say, you know, this person didn't put the comma in the right place and that person didn't have the exact right position on Albania. Instead of doing what we should be doing, which is trying to find common ground with each other and figuring out ways of working together, we often spend our time trying to figure out how I disagree with you and why I can't work with you. So I am going to make a pitch for those people who are concerned about medical assistance and concerns about Medicaid expansion. I work with a group, Pennsylvania Cares for All. We need people in suburban Philadelphia, suburban Pittsburgh, in the Wilkes-Barre-Scranton area, in the Altoona area. We need people in moderate Republican areas to come forward and work with the city delegations to be successful. And so anyone who is interested, please visit our webpage at www.pacaresforall.org and find a way of working with us. We're not perfect. There are some things that you may not agree with that we do. Some people I understand are a little upset at our activism, and I know you covered our arrest in Harrisburg in front of the governor's mansion.
Yep.
And, you know, I hear people are unhappy with some of those tactics, but I think we have to be clear that it's going to be more than one tactic, that it's not just logic. It's not the fact that we have a better argument and we make more sense. It's about political power and being organized and finding a way to work with other progressives.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, and which is why I think as a whole, the right has done a much better job of mending their fences, because they understand empire, as where I think the left, where progressives in the left, they understand fiefdoms. We have our little part here, and you have your little part, and we don't come together. And I think the money by the billionaire class helps them understand empire a little better, though.
Well, I think that you're right, but I also will tell you honestly, I had an epiphany when Obama was running the first time for president in the primaries. And I realized someone my age, if Richard Nixon, one of the most hated elected officials of all time, if he had run in the primaries, in the Democratic primaries in 2008, he would have been to Obama's left. And he would continue to be to Obama's left. You know, he believed in price and wage controls. He believed in the expansion of EPA. He believed in the expansion of LIHEAP and welfare programs, all things that the Obama administration has not stood up for. And we sometimes have forgotten how far to the right the country has drifted because those of us who don't share that ideology have failed really to make an effort to organize ourselves.
And that's what we need to be doing, and we need to be pushing back against governors like ours and across the country. Last question I've got for you before I wrap this up. Tomorrow, are you expecting anything good out of this, anything on education, anything to come from the governor that's going to at least be reasonable, or are we going to see more of what we've seen the last two speeches?
Well, I do think that he the Republicans lost enough state Senate races in Pennsylvania, and that the suburban Republicans are concerned about what the future holds, that he'll moderate. The problem is, when we go through the list of all the horrible things he's done, a moderate position is I'll only hurt you half as much,
right,
which is really not a moderate position. You know, my question to people who talk about reasonable, you know, that poverty will always be with us and infant mortality will always be with us and suffering will always be with us, and they say, let's be reasonable. I say, okay, if you want to be reasonable, let's make it your child who doesn't have an adequate education. Let's make it your child who has to try and go to school and study in a home that has no heat and no electricity. Let's make it your family that doesn't have health care. Because if we're going to be reasonable and accept it for someone, we ought to be reasonable and accept it for you.
I'm right there with you. And that's an excellent way of looking at it. Lance, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you very much. I always like it. And I hope people are supporting your show because there's very few places we have an outlet to talk like this.
So
I always appreciate hearing from you and getting on the air.
Thanks so much. Lance Haber, Director of the Mayor's Office of Consumer Affairs down there in Philadelphia. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The powers that be say that the bulk of America's middle-class manufacturing jobs are gone and won't be coming back. High-tech jobs are being outsourced too, as are accountants, lawyers, and some other professional positions. So where does this leave us? Grasping at straws, the most abundant of which are retail jobs. But wait, those aren't jobs, they're jobettes. Part-time, poverty pay, no benefits, lousy schedules, little training, and no advancement opportunity. Most big retail chains treat their employees as nothing but a drain on profits, not an asset to invest in. Salespeople are typically paid only $10 an hour, clerks get only $9.70, and cashiers just $9. Worse, 94% of retailers define full-time work as only 30 hours a week. People can't make ends meet on that, and America can't have a healthy economy without a solid middle class. Yet 15 million people are in retail work now, and it's to be our second biggest source of new jobs for the next decade. Well, shrug the powers that be, the retail giants must compete on low prices, so they have no choice but to keep cutting corners on their workforce. As we say in Texas, bovine excrement. Look at Trader Joe's, where full-time jobs start at $40,000. Or at Costco, where employee retainment is a priority and 98% of managers are promoted from within. low-price chains that invest directly in workers are reaping industry highs in performance, morale, customer satisfaction, and profits. Bad jobs are not a retail necessity, just a corporate choice. This is Jim Hightower saying, this week, a Retail Justice Alliance has been launched to push America's employers and policymakers to turn retail jobs into good jobs that spread a middle-class standard of living and rebuild our grassroots economy. Learn more at RetailJusticeAlliance.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Forbes magazine, big story. Where not to die in 2013. Because, you know, hey, the poor wealthy. We got to worry about the very poor wealthy. You know, the people who are going to have to pay some severance, some estate tax, some inheritance tax, maybe if you're, you know, in the obscene world. 21 states in the District of Columbia, they have some estate tax, some inheritance tax. Pennsylvania only has an inheritance tax. A number of other states, they have the, like New York, for instance, has the estate tax. A couple other states like New Jersey and Maryland, they've got both. And the question is, you know, how much? Like New York, for instance, if you had, let's say someone died in, they had $5.25 million. You would owe no federal tax, but you'd owe about $420,000 in state tax, because according to the reports, they have a 16% estate tax with an exemption of $1 million. And a number of other states do kind of the same thing. And the question then becomes, okay, let's say we don't tax those things. Because, well, evidently we're going to let the wealthy get away with this as well. Let's say we don't, because we have in the past. This is how we fund education. This is how we funded healthcare. This is how we funded roads, bridges, all the things that we need, that we use, that created the wealth for them in a lot of cases. If not there, then who? Well, I think pretty simple. The folks at the Institute on Taxation and Finance, a study we talked about last week, pointed out that, you know, poor people, you're the one footing the bill. And while states like California, Hawaii, Vermont, New Jersey, Oregon are the top five highest tax states for the top 1%, Pennsylvania fell into the category of, guess what? If you're in the top 1%, you paid about three times less than someone in the bottom 20%. And yet we're broke. And I hear this all the time. You know, we're broke, right? Yet someone making less than $19,000 here in the Commonwealth, they pay about, well, something over 12%, or around 12% of their income in state and local taxes, as where someone who's in the one million range pays only 4.4%. Something seriously wrong there. And, you know, it really kind of throws cold water on that whole producer parasite paradigm that we keep hearing about. You know, those poor people, that 47%, they're not paying their fair share. Yet, I look at this study. How can you argue with it? The more money you make, the less tax you pay. Seems completely opposite to me. And it's the same argument that the right is making for, well, you know, we need to have a sales tax on everything statewide. So, again, it would be just this, because, you know, the people at the bottom who spend 100% of everything they bring in, they would be taxed on 100% of everything they bring in. Someone making $1 million a year, well, obviously they're not going to spend $1 million a year, so they're going to be taxed on a much lesser amount. And I guarantee this situation that the the folks there at the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, their little study, the 12% that the bottom 20% pay would be much higher than that. And the 4.4% at the top 1% would be much less than that. Which is why you see a lot of these governors around the country wanting to go to this. I think it was Virginia, for instance. North Carolina. Let's just do away with our state income tax, our corporate tax. We'll just go to a sales tax. And for me, it's really upside down. And I look at this report by the Institute on Taxation and Finance, and the main finding of the report, virtually every state and their tax system is unfair, fundamentally, systematically unfair to the lower end of the economic scale, from the middle class on down. And this whole idea of consumption taxes are only going to make the situation that much worse. I was at the mall the other day, and I heard this couple arguing. And I think I talked about this last week, and it's really stuck in my head. Husband and wife were walking down, and I think they were husband and wife. She's talking about Phil Mickelson and how, well, they're going to take 90% of everything he makes. And he's like, no, here are the facts. This, and this. This is reality. I heard it on the radio, and I heard so-and-so say such and such. And she was in the believe category. He's saying, look, these are the facts. This is what the federal government's going to charge. This is what the state government's going to charge. This is what the local government's going to charge. This is that. Here it is. And he even went into some of that. I give him credit. He tried to be calm, and he went into the loopholes that they get. She'd have none of it. And I'd say that the right has done a very masterful job. And the Tea Party people did a fantastic job because, look, as I've been saying for the longest time, I believe the bottom 20%. They're taxed enough already. I think the next tier up and the next tier after that, taxed enough already. If you're in that middle income, that $36,000 to $58,000 range, you're paying over 10% of your income to the state and local taxes. I'm with you. You're paying more than double what our friends in the top 1% are getting away with. Something's fundamentally wrong with that. And I guess it comes back down to who we put into these offices. Who sits in our elected offices? Do you want somebody? And I'm hung up on this Bloom thing. I'm hung up on the statement that people on Medicaid would be better off with no insurance. I mean, I'm really just kind of sticks with me that you would have an elected official who would, and I'm not sure if stupid is the right word. I don't know that ignorant is. Foolish, maybe. Ideological, definitely. He got a talking point. Someone sent it to him. He goes, hey, this sounds good. Poke at Medicaid. Now, I go back to when I was a kid. Probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for some measure of state health care. I was 11 years old, had a really serious asthma attack, ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. My mother didn't have health insurance at the time, and we didn't have any money. You know, maybe had I had insurance, maybe we'd have gone to the doctor a week earlier when everything started. Which is why I'm in favor of expanding Medicaid and expanding coverage for folks. Blows my mind. Quick break, right back after this. Going to talk a little bit more about the big budget. Right back. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
In early 2013, a new company called Deep Space Industries became the second company in about a year to join what's being called the New Asteroid Gold Rush.
Scientists have known for decades that there are rich fields of water and precious metals available in near-Earth asteroids. Now, for the first time, companies are seriously queuing up to be among the first to gather those resources. Deep Space Industries has announced plans to build what it calls the world's first fleet of commercial asteroid prospecting spacecraft.
Deep Space Industries' chairman is Rick Tumlinson, who signed up the world's first space tourist, led the team that took over the Mir space station, was a founding trustee of the XPRIZE, and more. His company has named its first class of spacecraft Firefly, and said the craft will be launched in 2015 on journeys that'll last 2 to 6 months.
Then, starting in 2016, Deep Space says it'll begin launching a larger craft called Dragonfly for round-trip visits to asteroids that'll bring back samples.
More than 900 new asteroids that pass near Earth are discovered every year. Deep Space said that those asteroids can be like the Iron Range of Minnesota was for the Detroit car industry last century, a key resource located near where it was needed.
In this case, the vision is to use metals and fuel from asteroids to expand the in-space industries of this century. We have more at EarthSky.org. Search for asteroid mining. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
Well, tomorrow, the big budget address, the State of the State, and, you know, the whole premise being we're broke. I mean, I've heard it from virtually every one of my Republican friends says, Rick, we're broke. We don't have the money. It's all gone. The lights are going to go out. The pension situation, we're billions and trillions of dollars in hock. It's the end of the world. We can't do anything. And I don't buy it. To me, it's about priorities. It's about choices. And sorry, I don't buy that we need to sell off the liquor stores to fund education. And sorry, I don't buy that we need to sell off the lottery to fund senior programs. Sorry, I don't buy we're broke. What I do buy is that we have handed too much to too few. We've allowed too many loopholes for more handouts to too few folks. We need to be looking at that. We need to be changing that. And that magical box there in Delaware, we should probably be looking at that as well. Which is why I've asked Sharon Ward, the executive director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, to come talk to us about tomorrow's big speech. Sharon, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem, Rick.
So we're broke. We're broke. We can't do anything. We've got to sell everything off. Clearance sale. Everything's got to go.
Wrong. I have to tell you the main reason that we have any problem is that we have given away $2.5 billion tax cuts just this year alone, 10% of the state budget. So you can't keep making tax cuts to companies and not asking them to create any jobs and then cry poverty. But that's what's happening in Pennsylvania.
$2.5 billion this year alone?
Yes.
Wow.
And
that doesn't sound broke to me.
Nope, not at all. You're right. It's a matter of priorities. They have given away money to profitable corporations, and they look the other way while those same companies hide their profits in Delaware and Nevada and the Cayman Islands.
So let me ask you this. Hold on, because I just saw this. Someone sent me a story about Krugman and Carly Farina this weekend on TV. On, you know, Farina saying, you know, those public sector jobs, those aren't real jobs. What if we would have taken $2.4 billion and created $30,000 a job with health care? What would that have done for our unemployment rate? Because evidently, these corporations aren't doing it.
Nope, they have. You know, they have built up big cash reserve, they've bought back their stock, They've done pretty much everything but create jobs. So we would have done much better off if we spent that money on investments and things that actually do create jobs, like, you know, hire back those 20,000 education workers that we lost when Governor Corbett cut $1 billion out of the education budget. Keep people in work. That's what we need.
Absolutely. I've been saying for the longest time, what we've got is we've got a jobs crisis. We don't have a budget crisis. We've got
right.
a jobs crisis. Because if we were creating jobs, if we had those 20,000 people who were teaching our children, maybe we wouldn't have to sell education. We don't have to sell education off anyway. That's a want. That's a priority. That's a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, the problem we have now is that the governor wants to use gimmicks to make up for all of the ground that we've lost. Selling the liquor stores, it's going to dig us further in a hole in the long run. And certainly the pension changes that he's talking about, again, are illegal, and frankly, they are not going to do anything to solve the problem. What we need to do is stop giving the money away.
I'm with you. How much do you expect to come out in tomorrow's speech about the pension in real specifics, or will he just talk in platitudes and in big ideas?
No, I think we'll finally get a glimpse tomorrow of what the plan is. We think that they are going to be, they've taken the money and spent it, and so they're going to have to justify how they're, you know, taking the money that should go to pay for pensions and where they're spending it. So we should hear a little bit.
We keep hearing the big number, $511 million in pension payments. That's the big number they're throwing out to shock us. Where'd that money go?
The money went to a lot of other things. This is the way I like to think about it. My kids just got done with college, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, we've taken out loans, and they have to pay the money back. That's exactly what this government did. They took the money they should have been spending on pensions. They spent it for other purposes, and now it's time to pay, but they want to spend the money on something else, and that just doesn't fly. So don't be shocked by that, by the $500 million. The truth is that for most of the past 20 years, Pennsylvania has paid a reasonable share of money towards the pensions, and they just took a holiday, and now the time to pay the piper, and they want the money on something else.
That's kind of like what they've done on the federal level of Social Security. I remember Alan Simpson saying, "Well, it's all gone. We spent it. Yeah, they spent it. And
yeah,
get over it."
Yep. So now all of these things, they're just not central. The government's got to do what the government's got to do. It's got to provide education. It should keep college tuition low. It's got to help to support health care, making sure that hospitals are getting reimbursed for people who don't have health care, or, God forbid, actually helping people to have health care themselves. But they're not doing that. They're talking about privatizing the lottery, which isn't going to generate any more money than we do simply by doing the same thing, which is expanding the number of sites and adding new games. And, you know, they're talking about the liquor stores. And, again, what we're going to see is more alcohol-related problems, more deaths on the highways, and overall a loss of revenue for the state, both in taxes and also in liquor store profits. And a smarter plan would simply be to modernize the liquor store, keep them, expand the number of them, and you have both. You have responsible alcohol policy and a little bit more convenience.
But that's too common sense, and you would have to actually believe in government to do that. I mean, the folks who are running our government are people who don't actually believe in what they're doing.
Yeah, I say that they like their ideas are manufactured by Keebler elves. You know, they have no sense of reality. They just think them up sitting in the trees. So, these are all common sense solutions to all these problems.
And to highlight that point, I look at my representative, Representative Stephen Bloom, who was quoted today as saying that people covered by Medicare are worse off than people who have no insurance.
What I said, it's the Keebler elves. They gave him that idea because it, that absolutely not true. There's nothing like that in reality. In fact, the opposite is true. There's actually a study done in Oregon where they had people who were eligible for Medicaid and got services, and people who didn't, and they were able to prove, you know, beyond a shadow of doubt, that if you have health insurance, you've got better health outcomes, you work more, all of those things. So, nope, just wrong.
Yeah, see, you and your facts. See, you got to come to the, in your analogy, the Keeper Elf world. You got to come to the I believe world.
Never let the facts get in the way of a good story, and that's what the Republicans are doing.
And it's all along the line. I mean, you look at the pension thing that they're going to talk about. I sat in on their hearings. They themselves were told by their own people, if you go to a defined contribution plan, it is going to be more costly. It is going to cost much more over the life of the plan. But again, it's about belief.
Right. That's right. It's not about the facts, you know, and you gotta hand it to, one of the leading proponents of these defined contribution plans in Pennsylvania, who admitted that, yep, his plan's going to cost more. So that's not what we want. We don't want to take away retirement security for public employees, and we don't want to charge the taxpayer more. And yet, that's what the plans that our buddies in Harrisburg are promoting will do.
Yeah, I mean, I look at all of the cuts, the education cuts, the health care cuts, you know, down the line, the social services cuts, all of this stuff that this governor has done, and I ask myself, how much worse can it get? How much more of a pound of flesh do you have to give? Before A, they'll create jobs, or B, someone will, before we cry uncle.
Well, what we have now, though, I think, is we've got sort of, we'll see the wolf in sheep's clothing. I mean, the Quinnipiac poll that came out last week had some really dismal numbers for the governor.
Yep.
24% of women in Pennsylvania would support him for reelection.
Well,
that
yeah, I mean,
abysmal.
Isn't he the guy who said they don't have to watch; they can just turn their head while being probed and forced to undergo one of the ultrasounds? I mean, at some point, you got to go. 24%. What's wrong with you?
Right, you think that's a lot, right?
Well, I do.
What happened? What's the matter with that 24% of people of women? But look, here's the reality. The governor understands that he's in trouble. I think he understands that he's promoted a set of policies that are really unpopular with Pennsylvanians. So what he's done is, or what we think he'll do tomorrow, is something that's really cynical. Not to say, yeah, education is really important, but to say, I want to get pension changes and I want to privatize liquor stores and I can't get my way unless I link it to education. That's really, really cynical. And frankly, I think it's going to backfire on that.
I'm hoping it does because, you know, I saw it was, I think it was Scarnati who had the press conference last week who said, you know, we shouldn't be linking things at this hour. Something along the lines of basically it's doomed if they do. And I'm hoping he's right. There was part of me that wondered, you know, why he came out and he said what he said.
Well, I think that they've heard for the past 2 years about the real impact of the education cuts. I think they've, you know, look, when you hear from your school superintendent that you've got kids in study hall instead of electives and advanced math in high school, you know, yeah, parents aren't going to put up with stuff. So they've heard that over and over again. The Republicans lost a number of seats in the Senate this year in part because of the education cut. So when the governor comes out and says, you know, the only way I'm going to increase education spending is if it's going to illusory pension savings that I'm going to make up or selling the liquor stores, you know, these lawmakers are more pragmatic. They understand that that's not going to fly.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. Last question I've got for you. Now, what does it say about us as a society when we're talking about funding education with vice spending and we're funding programs for our most vulnerable, our seniors, on vice spending? What's it say about us?
Well, I think it says something about our elected leadership, but I think it also says something about how broken our political system is and how we've got, I'll go off on this tangent for a moment. You know, you've got a system in which elected officials, you know, they gerrymander districts so that they're picking their constituents rather than the other way around. and they end up with districts in which they give an extraordinary amount of power to a very small minority, the Tea Party, you know, minority and viewpoint, and that has really skewed our politics. But I do think things are moving back. I think Grover Norquist is shrinking so small that we can drown him in a bathtub.
That's the hope.
That's what we're hoping. So maybe things will be better.
Yeah, because I've been saying, you know, at some point these cuts, they work their way up to the people who vote. And I've been saying for the longest time, I don't understand why the people who got thrown under the bus by this governor, why they're not voting en masse. Why the 47% that Romney talked about, why they're not out en masse and in the streets angry about the things that have gone on. And maybe that's coming.
Well, I think that might be coming. But the other thing is they're working overtime, right? The way they're handling this is by working harder and working more hours, and they're really cynical about the political process. It doesn't work for them. It works for the rich people.
And well, you know, when you put people into power who tell you they don't believe in government, and then they go and they destroy it, well, what surprise do we have? Sharon, it's always great talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Will do, Rick. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks so much, Sharon Ward, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, PBPC.org, the website. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13, did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married. That is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone, and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl. It's good to know it's cause to give.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You can also email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, you look at all of these numbers. You look at $2.4 billion in a year they've handed out and telling us we're broke. And I look at this, you know, on the federal level as well. You look at how much corporate welfare we give out, and yet, you know, it's those poor people who are destroying the country, Rick, don't you know? No, I don't. And yesterday, Paul Krugman was on with, well, this Carly Farina, who, okay, you know, she's the right-wing mouthpiece doing her thing on with Stephanopoulos. And Farina goes off on this, well, you know, I think it's important to remember when we talk about the economy, that a private sector job and a public sector job are not the same things. They're not equivalent, according to her. She says, I'm not saying that public jobs aren't important, no, but private sector jobs pay for itself. Private sector jobs create other jobs. A public sector job is paid for by taxpayers. And Krugman, you know, chimes in, as he should have. He says, but when we say public sector jobs, it's not a bureaucrat in Washington. And Farina, oh, it is actually. And he says, no. He said, when we talk about public sector jobs, when we look at the ones that have been lost in large numbers in this, it's basically school teachers. Don't think about bureaucrats. It's school teachers. We've laid off hundreds of thousands of them. It's fixing potholes and repairing bridges. He said, what we've seen is an incredible drought of basic infrastructure and laying off of hundreds of thousands of school teachers. And this is what the right has done a really masterful job of doing. Anything that is supported by public spending, anything that we, the people, do, somehow flawed. It's not good enough. It's not the private sector, which right now is paying lower wages, lower benefits, and you're seeing the destruction of private employer health insurance, which I'm okay with. I never thought employers should be holding my health insurance. And women, honestly, look at what's going on with this Obamacare stuff with the companies like Hobby Lobby and Domino's Pizza, some of these other places. We don't want to pay for contraception for our employees. We want to be able to say what it is that they get. I mean, it's mind-blowing. You know, what if you worked for somebody and you didn't even know it? You took a job, you didn't even know that they were some way out bizarre religion and they didn't believe in, well, let's say, blood transfusions. And they say, well, we're going to provide you with that. Because this is where this then goes. We don't believe in blood transfusions. We don't believe in doctors. So we're going to buy health insurance that's not going to provide you doctors or blood transfusions. You'd say that's insane, wouldn't you? And I got an email from someone who's been listening to the program since its inception. And she said, you know, I remember the conversation that we had years ago when I told her, look, you know, it's not about Roe. It has very little to do with that. It's about Griswold. It's about going back all the way to the beginning and refighting the entire women's movement. And here we are. Not more than, I think it was 6-7 years ago we had that conversation. And here we are. I mean, in blatant. And she said, well, how did you know? And I'm going, well, you read what they're saying to themselves. You read what comes out of these think tanks. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that this governor is going to try and screw pensioners, is going to try and screw these folks who are working towards a pension, and the people who are coming behind us. It's not hard to figure that out. It's not hard to figure out what he's going to change and not figure out how, it's not hard to figure out what he's going to tie together. We need to sell the liquor store so we can put books in the classroom. 20 years ago, we'd have looked at that as a country and one, laughed the guy out of office. But two, we'd have been in the streets over it. Vice spending for our most precious asset, the future of our nation, vice spending the care for the people who made this country what it is. Are you kidding me? But that's where we're sitting right now. You know, I think back, you know, over the years and you go, you know, we haven't had a transportation bill go through here in a couple of years. Federal level, nothing big yet. And I think you're back 20 years ago, what would we have said or done? I mean, really, to me, all of our problems are solved by getting people back to work. So I don't care if it's a public sector job, a private sector job, or I don't care if Martians come and hire us to do things. All of our problems, our debt, our deficits, our pension obligations, all of the problems that we've got. And look, we do have some problems. They're not unmanageable. They're not insurmountable. It's not the end of the world. And I love hearing on the pension front, you know, Rick, we got $44 billion pension obligation. Yeah, if there was no money in the fund and everyone left today, you're right, it would be $44 billion today. I mean, they use the same thing for Social Security. You know, trillions of dollars. Yeah, if everyone were to go today. And I look at what the folks from Boston College's Sloan Center on Aging and Work put out. They said that the ratio of workers paying Social Security taxes to each person collecting benefits will fall to 2.0 to 1 in 2034 compared to 2.9 to 1 in 2011. And, you know, the whole point is, well, we got to scare people and think, well, you know, we can't afford it. So we've got to cut back benefits, got to raise the age. And I say, you know, one, create some more jobs. Two, start talking about this whole independent contractor, this misclassification stuff. Maybe start thinking about that as well. But the other part of this is let's start talking about bringing manufacturing back. Well, Murkowski talked about being energy independent. Why can't we just be independent? I guess that's a little too difficult to talk about. But I'm hoping to see something tomorrow on transportation, and we will talk about that as well. Quick break. Back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The International Longshoremen's Association says it's confident that ILA members will be satisfied with the details of the master contract agreement at East Coast ports. ILA President Harold Daggett said he can assure ILA members that, quote, the protections of our jurisdiction and increased benefits and wages were achieved, end quote. The tentative agreement reached Friday must still be ratified by both ILA members and the members of the United States Maritime Alliance. Local port agreements must also still be concluded. Daggett says the union came away from this negotiation with landmark agreements on automation, protection of chassis work, and powerful jurisdiction language. Daggett says the ILA now will turn its full attentions to achieving equally successful local agreements. The deal averted a possible strike ahead of a February 6th deadline.
for the negotiations. As the Affordable Care Act heads towards full implementation in 2014, SEIU Healthcare Chair Dr. Tony Lewis says one of the most important issues for SEIU is the continuing disparity in healthcare access in America along economic and racial lines.
Health inequality tied to income inequality is the biggest issue of our time right now, and the Affordable Care Act is a great tool to move us forward. There still exists so many disparities in care based on your income, the color of your skin, where you happen to live. That's just not right in this country. I feel there are opportunities in the Affordable Care Act, whether it's the $11 billion going into community health centers, whether it's the focus on prevention, whether it's the deep activity that SEIU and community organizations are doing to enroll everyone in all different communities to fix that.
Another chapter in the relentless attack on union rights for workers is beginning to unfold in Pennsylvania. Right-wing Republicans are pushing so-called right-to-work legislation in Pennsylvania that could cripple the ability of unions to collect dues and keep all workers in an organized workplace as union members. The Center for Media and Democracy says it's no accident that this is coming soon after a similar push in Michigan. The center says it's part of an effort by American Legislative Exchange Council backed by a witch's brew of right-wing groups like the billionaire Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and the Tea Party. Brandon Fisher of the Center for Media and Democracy says this looks like a state-by-state march attacking unions and labor rights in an effort to weaken progressive politicians and progressive groups. Those efforts have already been made in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale told Working in These Times the right-to-work attack is firmly opposed by Democrats and some union-friendly Republicans in the state legislature. He says the measure has been blocked before, and he believes it will be blocked again. Governor Tom Corbett, though, has said that if the Pennsylvania legislature passes the anti-union bill, he will sign it.
This newscast made possible in part thanks to underwriting from the OPEIU, Office and Professional Employees International Union.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So tomorrow, the governor is going to give his big speech, and I fully expect, and I think everyone does, we're going to say the only way we can fund education in Pennsylvania is if we sell off the liquor store. So liquor for education, there's a lot to be made out of that. Over the last 2 years, we've cut $1 billion each of the last 2 years from education, this whole privatization push. And last week was Mixed School Week Choice. A bunch of events across the country. Big money pushing to privatize education. I can't wait for the future. Which is why I've asked Andy Cody. He's an education blogger at Education Week magazine. Also a retired science teacher. What should we be doing with education? Maybe he's got some ideas. Anthony, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks. I think we're facing a dilemma where policymakers have decided that standardized tests are the only thing that will fix our schools, and then meanwhile they've been cutting the budgets, and the result is that really our public schools are really having a very hard time. The whole school choice week was really an attempt to almost abandon the public schools, in a sense, and say that since they're hopelessly broken, we should shift over to sort of free market alternatives. And it's almost like the marketplace is going to cure what the public schools couldn't. The only problem with that is that so far the schools that have been offered as competitors to the public schools really are not doing any better. And meanwhile, our public schools are really taking a lot of hits.
Yeah, because they're being defunded right before our very eyes.
Yeah, and this liquor idea is sort of a crazy example of 10 or 20 years ago we were funding schools with the lottery. Now it's going to be liquor. The next thing they'll have a hooker's tax to pay for the schools.
And that's what I said. We should be, if we're going to fund our vital services through vice spending, let's open it all up.
Sure.
It doesn't make any sense to me, but you know, maybe there'll be some jobs out of it since this governor won't do anything on that vein either. But I look at all of the money.
Well, you know, prostitution starts at the top.
Good point. But I look at all of the money that went into pushing this choice week that they kept throwing out there. And I go, you know, if we spent that kind of energy, that kind of resource, that kind of organization in making our public schools world class. And, you know, I don't even know that we have bad public schools. There may be a handful that need help, and that's what they exploit. But you know, look at the amount of underfunding. I have a problem with the way we've been going about it.
Well, there are a lot of schools that do actually need help, and they need not only funding, but they need really a spiritual investment on the part of our community. You know, our public schools are really treasures in our community, and when our politicians go around saying that they're broken and basically abandoning them, then we really are in danger of losing some of the anchors within our community. So I think our public schools do need help, but they need help, the kind of help they're not getting right now.
Yeah, you know, I coach my daughter's basketball team. She's in fifth grade now, and I was talking to one of the parents who's a little bit older than the average, like me, than the rest of the folks. And I said, you know, I remember back in the 70s. When, you know, the school in my neighborhood was the center of the community. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. And the school was there open during the summer where you could go in and you could use the gym to play basketball or the, you know, whatever facilities they had. And actually, before Reagan, you could get lunch there at the school in some of the low income areas. That's all been eviscerated, all wiped out and destroyed. And we're moving towards this private model.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that we've noticed with the school choice is, for example, the charter schools are being offered as sort of an advantage over traditional public schools. But a lot of the charter schools have lower levels of special education students and English language learners. They've been found to be expelling students at far higher numbers. They have very high attrition rates. They're kind of washing out students who aren't able to meet their rigid discipline standards. And then as a result, those kids all wash back into the public schools, where the public schools are left with the kids who are more expensive to educate, the special education and English language learners. It's great to teach those students. And I taught a lot of them in my years in Oakland, but as a public school, it costs. You have to have smaller class sizes, you have to have special services, and those kids have lower test scores. So then, a lot of these schools are going around bragging about their test scores, but if you look closely under the surface, you find out that they are not serving the same population. And they're jettisoning students back into the public schools that are the more challenging students to educate.
And they're not doing all that much better, if at all better.
No, yeah, exactly. They're really not. The studies that have been done comparing them have really found very marginal differences, if any at all. And some of them actually do worse. There's quite a few of them that do worse. In fact, one of the issues that has come up is some of the politicians have been getting support from some of the for-profit charters like K-12 Inc.
Right.
K-12 Inc. is the largest virtual charter in the country. They have almost 100,000 students. Their CEO was paid $5 million salary in 2010, and they have been working around the country with the help of ALEC, which your listeners may have heard of,
yes,
to sponsor legislation that requires students to take online courses. So in effect, they're purchasing their market for, you know, by giving campaign contributions to politicians.
It's one big incestuous relationship where they're all in bed together, and we're paying for the party.
Yeah.
And you know what? I got one of the, I got a picture, and you brought up the cyber charters, the online courses, and someone sent me a picture of a kid, you know, saying, you know, it's school choice week because I believe in school choice because it gives me flexibility. And he's sitting there in front of two computer screens. And I gathered one that he would do his schoolwork on and the other that he would cheat on. And you go, explain to me how you're not doing better than the, because I don't think any of the cyber charters in Pennsylvania made AYP. I think there are 18
of them. And that's the thing about even K-12 Inc., only 27% of their schools made AYP. There was a study done by a guy named Gary Miron, M-I-R-O-N, who looked carefully at the quality of these virtual charters and found that they're really not a high quality alternative. And you know, this is one of the ways that one of the innovations that were being sold as something great and wonderful is ways to make education cheaper and more profitable, but not necessarily any better, and in fact often significantly worse.
But is it really cheaper? I mean, when you start factoring in all of the external costs, all of the societal costs that come along with it, the profit.
Well, it's cheaper if you don't care about the quality of the education the student receives. That's part of the problem is that you have, in essence, you have for politicians at least in the short run, there can be savings. And you can claim that you're being more efficient, and you know that's part of the problem with a lot of these schools, and also part of the problem with the fact that we've decided that we can determine quality by a set of standardized tests. Now you can have a very good school that has crappy test scores. I visited a couple months ago a charter school in Albuquerque that is doing some fantastic work, and they have recruited students who had already dropped out or who were at risk of dropping out, and they did it by creating a program focused on the building trade. They partnered with the construction industry, and they have a whole curriculum set up around engineering and architecture. And so the kids come, a lot of Latino males come. And they learn, you know, they're learning the construction trade, and it's highly relevant, highly engaging. They do not do a lot of test preparation, though, and of course these kids were academically behind when they came to the school. So they are, you know, if they're going to be judged by their test scores, they're going to look bad.
Right.
People, you know, and right now, even the, you know, right now, even the, some of the charter people are clamoring. Close down quote unquote bad charters. Well, you can't judge a school by test scores. If you do, good schools will be condemned and bad schools will be praised.
Let me ask you this then, because you know, there's a lot in this No Child Left Behind that I think is horrible. I think these standardized tests are ridiculous. I'm in line with the folks who say we should be opting out of this. In fact, I'm in the process of considering if I'm gonna have my kids opt out of them, because I
good
think
for you.
And I saw, you know, out in Washington and in Oregon and places, students and teachers are saying, you know, enough of this already. What is a measurement then? That says a school is, because this is what I'm wrestling with, because, you know, I know the question that's going to be thrown to me. Okay, you don't want your kids to take this test. Well, then what measurement would you suggest in place so that we know if a school isn't going in the right direction?
Well, I think first of all, teachers have a very good idea of where the students stand. And even a lot of the report cards that we're giving give very detailed, there's criterion-based report cards that explain exactly what skills the students have mastered and where they're struggling. So as a parent, there's certainly that way to find out, you know, how well your child is doing. If we want to do something for accountability purposes, I think it would make a lot more sense to have some trained observers who would go into schools. The schools would prepare portfolios of student work. There can be standardized tests. Part of the problem we have, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, we had standardized tests in mind. You know, I took the Iowa.
Iowa Basics. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, so it's not that, personally, I'm not in principle opposed to standardized tests. I'm opposed to saying that we ought to close down schools if their tests don't, if their test scores don't rise each and every year. You know, that, and that's the situation we have right now. I'm opposed to paying teachers according to test scores. I'm opposed to evaluating and firing teachers if their test scores don't go up. Because I don't think it's a valid indicator of quality. And I think it creates a false economy of quality, a false set of values that really punishes, can in fact punish really great teachers and can reward poor teachers.
Yeah, because I go back to my childhood, and there were no teachers who were going to be able to change the home lives of the vast majority of the kids that I grew up with, the poverty conditions that was outside of their ability. And, you know, when kids come to school hungry, or they come unprepared, or they haven't slept and have all of these problems with them, that's where I'm, all of this focus on testing, this is where I get off the train.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just responding to somebody who wrote something about how, educators have not been able to overcome systemic generational poverty. Well, for crying out loud, you know, I didn't know that I had signed up to repair the woes of the United States of America when I became a middle school teacher. You know, I was there to teach science, you know, and try to excite the kids, try to engage them. But this idea that our schools alone can reverse generations of poverty is absurd. You know, schools certainly have a role to play, but you know, when Martin Luther King wrote about fighting poverty, and he was certainly, if anybody knew something about the subject, it was him. He wrote in about 1967, I believe it was, that. You know, we will not solve poverty by these piecemeal programs in education and housing. We need a comprehensive program to attack poverty. We need to have guaranteed minimum wage. We need to have, you know, jobs programs. We need to do serious work to attack poverty in this country.
And if I remember right, they did not want handout programs, no welfare, no...
Right. Well, they didn't.
They wanted jobs programs. They wanted jobs programs.
You know, we've been sold this idea that we're in a time of austerity and there's not enough money for this or that. We have more wealth in this nation than anywhere in the world.
Yep.
You know, we're still the richest country in the world, even though we're not, you know, we're not the superpower we were 20 years ago. But, you know, there's plenty of resources to provide. We could provide the best schools in the world if we didn't want to spend all our money shooting bombs at people halfway around the world.
If we had the right priorities and if we made the right choices. And I looked at tomorrow's speech by the governor. It's all about priorities. It's all about choices. And we're going to choose to give more money to big corporations and, sell off state assets so that we might be able to fund education.
Well, you know, in California, in November, we chose to put on the ballot, the governor, Governor Jerry Brown, put on the ballot a tax, and we are raising several billion dollars a year additional funds for the state. After being a tax-cutting state for years, we finally stepped up and imposed the new taxes on ourselves so that our schools wouldn't take a huge hit. And as a result, we actually will have the revenue to support our schools, at least beyond the bare bones that they've been whittled down to over the last few years.
Well, good for you. But your governor didn't sign the Grover Norquist pledge, and we always honor our pledges, at least that, except for pensions for public workers. But we honor the important pledges, I guess.
Right, right. Right. It's funny how when they have contracts, They always have to obey all the rules of the contract, but it seems to me a pension is a sort of a contract as well, but they seem to find ways to break out of that.
Now, we've got so much work to do on this, Anthony. And I looked at last week, and again, I looked at the money. I guess they had a train tour? You were at one of the stops?
I don't know. Are you talking about the school's choice?
Yeah, the school. I guess all the money that they spent on the school choice week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the Koch brothers and them have quite a bundle to spend. So
it is. It's what we're being sold, and I say sold down the river. Anthony, it's great.
You know what's interesting? I wrote about this morning. There's some interesting confluence of some different political perspectives coming out on the standardized test thing. You know, I was at this school choice event in Arizona on Monday, and I was, you know, my comments about unions and public schools were not terribly well received. But when I criticized standardized testing, I got practically a standing ovation. People were very critical. These were very conservative people, even, you know, conservative libertarian Tea Party sort of people, and they were very, very anti-standardized testing and very agitated about the Common Core.
So that's
an interesting sort of development that on the conservative side there's beginning to be a backlash against standardized testing.
Oh, because eventually their school district's going to lose money because you're not going to achieve 100% proficiency. I just don't think you'll ever achieve
it. It's not so much that. It's more that they don't want what they see. They want to get public funding for their charter schools and even their parochial schools, and they don't want those schools to be dictated to in terms of their curriculum. And so what they see as the writing on the wall is that if the Common Core passes, then only government funds will only go to schools that are implementing the Common Core. And they don't want to have to implement the Common Core because they want to have their, you know, their conservative curriculum, you know, whether it's creationism or, you know, their own interpretation of U.S. history or whatever it might be.
Interesting. So we may see on the education front, much like we're seeing on the contraception front, with companies like Hobby Lobby saying we're not going to give our workers contraception because of the law. Says interesting. That's an interesting way of looking.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, in Indiana, their school superintendent race was won by a progressive educator who was critical of the guy who was a corporate reformer who ran, a guy named Tony Bennett, and he is connected with Jeb Bush's group. He's a big promoter of the Common Core, and this woman was a progressive supported by the union, but she was critical of standardized testing. She was the biggest statewide vote getter in the state of Indiana. She got 53% of the vote, which means she got conservative Republican voters to vote for her.
Interesting. That's something I'm going to have to
look
into.
A number of states are now backlashing out of the Common Core. They're pushing against it in Alabama and Oklahoma. A lot of states where conservatives are fairly strong, there's sort of an upswelling of resistance to it.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense because, you know, as you put it out, as you've stated, they don't want to be told what they have to teach, you know, like
exactly.
2 plus 2. Interesting.
Yeah.
Anthony, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Okay, so long, Rick.
Thanks so much, Anthony Cody, education blogger over at Education Week magazine. Quick break, back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
All about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
The powers that be say that the bulk of America's middle-class manufacturing jobs are gone and won't be coming back. High-tech jobs are being outsourced too, as are accountants, lawyers, and some other professional positions. So where does this leave us? Grasping at straws, the most abundant of which are retail jobs. But wait, those aren't jobs, they're jobettes. Part-time, poverty pay, no benefits, lousy schedules, little training, and no advancement opportunity. Most big retail chains treat their employees as nothing but a drain on profits, not an asset to invest in. Salespeople are typically paid only $10 an hour, clerks get only $9.70, and cashiers just $9. Worse, 94% of retailers define full-time work as only 30 hours a week. People can't make ends meet on that, and America can't have a healthy economy without a solid middle class. Yet 15 million people are in retail work now, and it's to be our second biggest source of new jobs for the next decade. Well, shrug the powers that be, the retail giants must compete on low prices, so they have no choice but to keep cutting corners on their workforce. As we say in Texas, bovine excrement. Look at Trader Joe's, where full-time jobs start at $40,000. Or at Costco, where employee retainment is a priority and 98% of managers are promoted from within. Low-price chains that invest directly in workers are reaping industry highs in performance, morale, customer satisfaction, and profits. Bad jobs are not a retail necessity, just a corporate choice. This is Jim Hightower saying, this week, a Retail Justice Alliance has been launched to push America's employers and policymakers to turn retail jobs into good jobs that spread a middle-class standard of living and rebuild our grassroots economy. Learn more at RetailJusticeAlliance.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So the Washington Post had an interesting story that pointing out that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, thinking about possibly considering the idea of free internet access in major metropolitan cities and in a number of rural areas as well. And, you know, I think about this and I go, and who's pushing it? Who's in favor of it? Well, of course, people like Microsoft and Google. Who's against it? The people who provide wireless access. Of course, it's their business. But the FCC said, you know what, we should be doing this for a number of reasons. And there's a number of reasons why I think we should have free internet, the Wi-Fi in a lot of places. One, I mean, if this is the future of the country, that's the kind of access we need to have for everyone. Close that gap between those who can afford it and, well, those who can't. You want to help the bottom of the economic spectrum? Help them get a little spectrum. Think of it as a public good. I mean, the invention of it, the whole push forward, to my understanding, government money went into it for the public good. Man, I think the last thing I saw, we were 15th, 16th in the world in terms of the number of people who have broadband access, the speed of our internet, and of course the price. And I saw this report that said something like 95, 96% of the people in this country live in areas with one or two or no internet providers. 5% of the people live without any internet whatsoever. And I go back and I think about, you know, the electrification, you know, back during the Truman years when we went out, we put electricity in everyone's house and we ran pipes to everyone's house. We did the whole plumbing thing. Hey, I got indoor plumbing. Good idea. Telephone, same thing. Why is the internet not the same thing? And it comes back down to something very simple for me. It comes back down to the money. These internet providers, it's about the money, man. And you go back and you think about all of the investments that we have made for ourselves. And there's part of me that goes, well, let's say the FCC decides we're going to do this. And we're going to raise ourselves up. We're going to be in the top five globally with access and price and availability and all of that stuff. We're going to be at the top. What kind of politician would be worth his weight and would be worth his salt if he didn't do what Corbett's going to do? Sell it off. Because there's some private corporation that will hold you hostage over it, right? I think there's some major benefits. I think there's some major good that could come of it. But here again, there are those like Corbett, those on the right who would say, well, we should put that out for bid and get the private company to do it. Because, of course, they always do it better. Have you ever driven long distances with your cell phone? When I was driving a truck for a living, there were places that no matter what time of day, what time of night, you would go through and it was dead. And it was dead for years. And you're stuck with that. Who are you going to complain to? The CEO? Good luck on that. Anyway, with tomorrow's speech, I'm not expecting our governor to say anything about Wi-Fi access for everyone. Because he'd probably sell it off if we did. I'm expecting to hear more of the same. But I think Sharon Ward was right talking. It's going to be a little bit softer. It's going to be a little more cynical. Because I think he has seen the polls. And the polling numbers, not good. When a majority of Republicans say you shouldn't be reelected, kind of a problem. And I wonder if he'll bring up anything about the gerrymandering. I know there's, you know, House Bill 94, and the Senate is about to put forth their bill, as I understand it, so that we can change how the electors are. I wonder if he'll bring that up tomorrow. It is a budget speech, but, you know, hey, that's a big budget issue, to make sure that the districts are drawn in such a way that, well, you get a Republican president who would not have to put health care into place. And, interesting. But for me, it's the Medicaid expansion. I'm kind of coming down on the side he's going to walk away from it. I'm coming down on the side that, you know, based on his history, based on what he has done over the past 2 years, I'm coming down on the side, and, you know, it's an educated guess. He's going to be against the expansion of Medicaid, even though you're talking about almost 800,000 people that would get health care in this Commonwealth. 800,000 people. And I guess the calculus is that those 800,000 people don't vote and that they wouldn't vote for him anyway. The question then comes, as you move further up the ladder, because you're talking about 800,000 people who would get some care, you're talking about improvements for you know, people all the way up the socioeconomic ladder. At what point do you begin hitting people who it's going to help? And I look at Ohio, where Kasich is going to take the Medicaid expansion money, because Ohio's in worse shape than Pennsylvania is with the percentage of people who are uninsured. He's done the calculus. I guarantee it's not in his ideology to pursue this, but he's done the electoral calculus, which is saying that we should probably do this because, I might not get reelected. And for me, it comes back to, you know, what's right? And would it be your kid? Going to be your family. Now, not too long ago, I met a guy who, you know, he'd use some of the social safety net programs. He was on unemployment, then he was on welfare for a bit, needed food stamps, needed help. And he said, never in my life did I ever think I was ever going to need it. And I remember when we did our food drive a number of years back, and I met Joe. Guy never missed a day at work in his life until he had a heart attack. After that heart attack, because he had health insurance, he ended up losing his job because he didn't come to work because he had no union contract to protect him. The laws were such that, you know what, you get X amount of time, 12 weeks in a year, and no obligation left to you. There's the door. Goodbye. He was out in the cold. End up losing his house, losing his home, homeless. Gets sick again. Now he's got some Medicaid. Because, of course, he didn't get the preventative care that would have probably stopped some of the other problems. We didn't catch any of that until way down the line. And I remember talking to him, and he stayed with us the entire week because he had nowhere else to go. And him saying, you know, I never imagined, never in a million years did I imagine I would ever be in this position, because he was born into relative wealth. Wasn't at the top of the food chain, but was near there. His family had money. And over the years, you know, hey, you know, things happen. And it dwindled away. He ended up dying about a couple weeks before Christmas. About a month after he had gotten Social Security disability. Guy who fought in Vietnam. Never asked for anything until he got sick. And it just, I keep thinking of that story. Because his memory is with me. Because that could be any one of us at any time. And when you talk about being part of the middle class, and you talk about any measure of security, health security has got to be right there. So while not, I may think Obamacare is not the greatest, the best thing, and it's not going to be the end, it's a step. And I got some grief from our 2 days at the Family USA conference, you know, saying, "Well, you're against parts of this," and I've been honest about that. I was honest there. But it is that step. Because maybe the next person who's Joe, maybe the next Joe doesn't have to go through that. Maybe he doesn't end up homeless. And maybe we do need to have a stronger social safety net that is a little more generous. But what we've got is we've got politicians who point the finger at the folks below them. Those people are hurting us, they say. Instead of the $2.4 billion we gave away this year and tax handouts. To who? Not Joe. To the big corporations. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Evan Ratner from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Still got it stuck in my head, the Ray Lewis quote. I don't know how much of it's real. I don't know how much of it is fake. I don't know how much of it is, hey, I need another career. But this whole coming to Jesus moment just kind of, I don't like it. And the whole quote, that interview he had with Shannon Sharp where he was speaking to the family of the two people who were killed, and this just blows my mind. He says, quote, to the family, if you really knew the way God works, he don't use people who commits anything like that for his glory. No way. It's the total opposite. So it's nice to be condescending and just, well, I guess it is what it is. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually in the middle here with a bunch of South Sudanese ministers that are visiting the United States. We have some people talking about freedom of the press.
And what kind of freedom, what kind of press do we have in South Sudan?
Well, there is an active press. There's just not terrible freedom, and I give them a lot of grief about it.
As you should. I mean, you know, and here at home as well, you look at around the world, we're not all that far ahead, some would argue.
Well, I hate to say it, as bad as we think it is here, we're ahead of South Sudan where they put you in jail if you criticize.
Well, at least
government.
You're not getting shot, I guess, right?
Right.
So what is the situation there? I know you spend an awful lot of time in South Sudan, and you do an awful lot with Goats for the Old Goat. And I know we've been running an ad to get people to buy some things to help folks out there. How are things going there?
Well, I think they're going pretty well. I mean, I think that they have to deal with corruption. They have to deal with the fact that the North considers them insects, that they still have 35,000 people in slavery. There's a lot of problems, and the slavers in the Arab North. So actually, we got the one of the unions, the machinist union, is doing a small little training program there. And so we're trying to train people so that they are self-sufficient.
Yeah, I mean, and I just had a conversation with a guy the other day who's going to Haiti. And, you know, talking about the exact same thing. How do you make these folks self-sufficient? How do you get them industry that's going to help them be able to create jobs and survive? Not make globally competing companies, but just, you know, simple things to get a local economy operating and moving and creating jobs and helping folks, you know, be able to feed their families.
Exactly. And that is the problem.
Yeah. So what's going on here? I see the vice president's in France. What's going on with that?
Well, the vice president has been in Germany and France. And, today he said to the French president that they are going to be active in terms of climate change. You know, the French are very, very concerned. They think Americans don't care about things like climate change. And so the vice president assured the French that the United States is going to do something. I don't know what we're going to do, but I guess we're going to do something.
We're going to do something. You're right. Don't know what it is, but something is what we'll do. Did you see Lisa Murkowski's speech this morning? And her press conference on her new energy policy, which is a lot like the old Republican energy policy, just with a whole bunch of new definitions.
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, I mean, why am I not surprised?
Well, it's drill, baby, drill with new words.
Right,
basically
exactly.
What it is. And a new definition of what clean energy is. I love that.
Right. And unfortunately, you know, we have the technology to do clean energy. And we can turn places like Pennsylvania into real models. But there isn't the political will, I guess.
No. But yeah, I loved the way she said, you know, clean energy should be those things that, you know, that we don't really worry about those externalities and all of those extra costs. It's just whatever's cheap because we need abundant and cheap, affordable, abundant, diverse, secure. You know, and of course, you know, she kept pointing to what's going on, what went on at the Superdome. With the power going out, I guess you said that somebody, there's some investigation going into why?
Yeah, I guess the CIA is looking into it as to whether there was any kind of conspiracy going on.
Conspiracy of what? I mean, somebody, a terrorist attack, conspiracy, the Ravens?
I understand. It's crazy, but, you know, I think they have to rule out everything.
Okay. Because originally, you know, as I was watching it, I saw some reports, well, there are people who smell gas. And, you know, just a whole lot of speculation at that point.
For sure. For sure. Okay.
Yeah.
A couple other interesting things. The president was in Chicago today talking about guns. He said that he can see a consensus starting to develop around guns. I don't know whether there is or not, but the president is saying that. And I guess, you know, I guess he's been talking to several Republicans as well. So
yeah.
Let's hope there is a consensus.
Well, I mean, you look at what just, and the story broke, you know, they got that 5-year-old kid in Alabama away from the crazy guy that shot the bus driver. Then you see the story of
he's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. They got it, but the kid's okay. And then you look at this guy who, you know, started this organization to help folks with PTSD. This sniper, you know, glorified 150 kills plus whatever. He ends up getting killed by, I mean, the overabundance of guns didn't seem to help him very much.
No, that's for sure.
And something that...
And I took a position on Fox yesterday, and, oh, you should see the hate mail I'm getting.
Oh, good. What was that?
You know, well-regulated militia and all that kind of stuff, and they're saying that I'm a bad person.
That's kind of common sense. That's kind of what
right.
It is. Just a thought. Anyway, I see the Republicans are angry over the budget.
Oh, they're saying the president doesn't have a budget. Jay Carney today said, listen, there is an issue about not having a highly partisan budget. We want a budget that is going to pass. He's right.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'd like a budget that would pass, too, one that, you know, that we could pay our bills and not every couple of months end up in a situation where, uh-oh, it's another hostage situation where, uh-oh, our credit rating could tank and, uh-oh, it's going to get worse.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, Ellen, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking to you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the updates.
You got it.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
In early 2013, a new company called Deep Space Industries became the second company in about a year to join what's being called the new asteroid gold rush.
Scientists have known for decades that there are rich fields of water and precious metals available in near-Earth asteroids. Now, for the first time, companies are seriously queuing up to be among the first to gather those resources. Deep Space Industries has announced plans to build what it calls the world's first fleet of commercial asteroid prospecting spacecraft.
Deep Space Industries chairman is Rick Tumlinson, who signed up the world's first space tourist, led the team that took over the Mir space station, was a founding trustee of the XPRIZE, and more. His company has named its first class of spacecraft Firefly, and said the craft will be launched in 2015 on journeys that'll last 2 to 6 months.
Then, starting in 2016, Deep Space says it'll begin launching a larger craft called Dragonfly for round-trip visits to asteroids that'll bring back samples.
More than 900 new asteroids that pass near Earth are discovered every year. Deep Space said that those asteroids can be like the Iron Range of Minnesota was for the Detroit car industry last century, a key resource located near where it was needed.
In this case, the vision is to use metals and fuel from asteroids to expand the in-space industries of this century. We have more at EarthSky.org. Search for asteroid mining. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great...
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Oh, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Skeet truthers. Skeet birthers. Evidently, I don't know if you saw the picture, a picture of President Obama being very manly with a gun. The White House released a picture of Obama shooting at the, I don't even know Camp David had a gun range, but it does. And on August 4th, which I guess is Obama's birthday, he was out there with the gun shooting. Do you care? I go, you know, is this one of those things that he would do on a or is this just a photo op? And I generally, you know, I'm generally very skeptical. It would be like me. I went out target shooting. I've done it a couple of times. I see no great thrill in it. Okay, I hit the target. Isn't that what I was supposed to do? Yeah, I guess. Anyway, the big picture there, there are folks who don't believe it. The spokesman for the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, said, you know, one picture does not erase a lifetime of supporting every gun ban and every gun control scheme imaginable. And yet when he was asked about the commercial that the NRA put out about Obama's children, even Chris Wallace, the Fox guy, said, it's ridiculous what you did. Speaking of ridiculous, my congressman, Lou Barletta, was on with Paul Krugman. They were on the Stephanopoulos, whatever, I forget whatever the name of his show is, and talking about the whole gun issue. The obnoxious quote that came out was, well, you know, would banning spoons stop obesity? Because, you know, Paul Krugman points out that countries that have effective gun control measures have a lot fewer of the big shootings and shootings in general. No gun, no shootings. A little difficult to do. And I look at this weekend, I mean, with the thing in Alabama, I look at the thing down in Texas with the guy, the sniper guy, and you go, yeah, maybe you would have wanted to kill those people. Maybe. And I get it. That's the gun that actually did it. You know, it's the person who pulled the trigger and all that, but the gun really helped a lot. And the more I look at this, the more I say I'm hoping that rational, reasonable people come to some level of sanity. This argument, and I listened to LaPierre talk to Chris Wallace, you know, this idea that we're going to put armed guards in every school and armed guards in every classroom, and then eventually it comes down to every movie theater. And is that the world that we want to live in? Not me. And this whole push towards we need more guns. I'm kind of like the line said, you know what? We need less guns. And maybe there should be. To get a car, to drive a car, you know, I had to take a test. Maybe some thoughts of being responsible. And these are questions that have to be discussed and debated and all of that. I get it. But it's amazing how many people I talk to who said, you know, we need to do something. And I read this article over the weekend about the NRA, and you know, it's one of those things where you go, yeah, I knew that. I've known that for years. So the way they've built their power is by strong-arming people. I get it. You want to own a, you want to participate in one of their gun events. You got to have a, if your gun club wants to participate, you got to have 100% membership. And it filters down through that whole culture, and it's all money. And I sit back and I just kind of shake my head and wonder where we're going with all this. And, you know, maybe there's part of me that says, and I had a friend the other day said, you know, you better keep your gun. When the government comes for you, you're going to have to stand up and fight for yourself. And I said, I don't think it'll be the government doing it. I think it'll be private for-profit corporations that end up doing that. And I saw just recently, I think it was Friday, that Rand Paul, the senator, from the Republican from Kentucky, introduced this on the federal level, the same no rights at work nonsense that we see here on the state level and across the country. And in the press release, he says that he cares about those American workers, cares because they deserve the right to freedom of association. He said that he's concerned, deeply concerned, with the 26 states that still allow forced union membership, even though there are none, because no one's forced to join a union. It just blows my mind that this keeps being put out there and nobody really pushes back against it. He says that the right-to-work laws ensure that all Americans are given the choice to refrain from joining. Again, you had the right not to join. It's already there. It's already right there. He said nearly 80% of all Americans support the principle. So he introduced the national no rights work agenda, which will require all states to give all their workers the freedom to choose. Love the freedom of choice, don't they? Not so much. 80% though. I was going, wow, that's, wonder where you pulled that number out. And the reality is you look at studies, in fact, the Economic Policy Institute did a study. And what they found was, is states who have the right to work laws, which you gotta love, it's great language, they actually pay lower wages and less benefits. And you don't need EPI, an economic think tank, to tell you that. We got Zach Womp, a Republican representative from Tennessee, saying, you know, Volkswagen came to Tennessee to pay lower wages and less health care, less pension. No more needs to be said. It's all about that. But you look at who funds someone like Rand Paul. Well, his third largest contributor, Koch Industries. And now you know why. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We will be back tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, infinite.